Hi, everyone. Happy holidays. It's Josh Nason, WrestlingObserver.com here with another edition of Josh Nason's Punch-Out, episode 85. So we come near the year end. We still got plenty of time before then, so I won't wish you a happy new year yet. I will wish you, again, happy holidays. If you guys are out Christmas shopping, Hanukkah shopping, if that's a thing, I can admit I don't know how that works, buying stuff for Kwanzaa, whatever it is that you celebrate this time of year, Festivus. Hopefully you have it with a smile on your face. You're relatively stress-free and getting ready for hopefully a good week ahead. For my day job, I do not have to work. There will be plenty of work here to do on the website, of course, as we head to the year end. But no day job, so that is good. They actually pretty much commanded us not to do any work, so we'll take that. Hopefully you guys are doing the same. I will tell you, for those that are working in any form or fashion, even those working on the holidays, I've been there. I get it. And I appreciate you guys, and other people should as well. Even, you know, all the people from like mall workers to like gas station workers and all these people you see every day that work on holidays, if you're doing traveling, things like that, we kind of take for granted that kind of sucks to be them, right? And I used to be one of those people working in pro sports. I worked seven straight New Year's Eves at one point, Easter's, day after Thanksgiving, sometimes Thanksgiving itself. So yeah, it sucks, but we appreciate you. Everyone appreciates you. And for those people who do have some time off, enjoy it. It is hopefully well earned. So with that sermon out of the way, let's get to the show. I got a long one for you, and for good reason. I have two guests helping me break things down. So again, this is the MMA Year in Review, as you probably could tell from the title if you've used this from the site. April, May, June, Q2 in the business world, or the majority of the business world. We go through this with two special guests. The first one covering April is Chad Dundas. You know him of Bleacher Report, an author, champion of the world, and also from the Co-Main Event podcast. He joins me for about 35 minutes or so to break down April. And then we move over to Sean Wheelock. You guys remember Sean Wheelock? He was a guest of mine some time ago, and he was a former voice of Bellator, now does a ton of work all over the place with combat sports, which we get into a little bit here. And he helped me break down May and June. June, I think, to this point, first half of the year might have been the biggest. Actually, it was the biggest news event month of the first half of the year, and you'll see why. A little boxing fight was made. I don't know if you guys had heard of that or not, but all kinds of other stuff happened as well. This is a really good one. A lot of stuff happened in this three-month stretch. Again, the first 3 months of the year, you kind of look back and and we're in the midst of it. It just seemed really kind of lame at times. And then you look back and it's like, oh, you got some stuff, GSP coming back, all this stuff. This next 3 month stretch really kind of advanced a narrative for a lot of those situations and happenings we saw in the first 3 months, as well as set up some big things for the second half of the year as well. A lot of questions we still need answered as well. So we'll get right into that. Coming up here for the next, 35 minutes with Chad, and then an hour and 26 minutes with Sean. He and I just go and talk and all that stuff. So you guys got plenty of stuff to listen to here over the next couple days, and I will join you after the interviews to bid you a fond farewell for the holiday season. So, Sean Wheelock, Chad Dundas, let's go right now. Enjoy. Well, we continue our look back at 2017, the year that was in mixed martial arts, and very glad to have someone on here that we haven't had on actually for a long time for no real good reason. Just but it's a good time to chat. Hopefully in the future we'll chat a bit longer. But we're going to talk about the month of April with the man that is the lead MMA writer for Bleacher Report. He is the co-host of the Co-Main Event podcast with friend of the show Ben Folks. And he's also author of the novel Champion of the World, which is available in hardcover and Kindle. 4.5 stars in Amazon reviews. Pick it up for your favorite person this Christmas time. We welcome back Chad Dundas to the show. And Chad, the real hardball question that we'll start with does not involve Christmas ornaments, but it does include a question. Are you rich now from all this merchandise you have on the Co-Main Event podcast page? This is tremendous stuff.
Oh, just rich beyond my wildest dreams, as I'm sure you can imagine, which is why I continue to be involved in having podcasts in the MMA space and just keep myself active. You know, just at this point, it's all gravy because I'm like Scrooge McDuck swimming in a swimming pool full of gold coins.
How did he manage to do that? Because if anyone that has touched coins realize that they're hard and have a pool of them, you would think it would like break his neck the minute he made impact? I mean, is this just the Disneyverse, or what is this? What is this physics that Scrooge McDuck lives in anyway?
I mean, I think it's a testament to the man's core strength, don't you think? Sort of like from the neck down, sort of like able to make the dive and then having the abdominals and hips and quadriceps to sort of get into a backstroke there in the pool full of money.
Well thought out. Well thought. You've had this discussion before, I take it.
I'm well versed in the physics of most cartoons, so. So if you want to talk about that, I'm good to go.
Oh, my God. Now we have to have a separate show about that. Wow. Okay. That is my mind is now blown with the possibilities. So we'll get back into this boring MMA talk. So actually, I want to ask you, your year, since we're doing kind of this year in review and looking back at the year that was, you've had a pretty good year. We were talking off air before that kid number three was this year. The podcast is going great. And obviously, the book has been going great. I mean, this, I assume it's been a pretty good year for you.
Yeah. 2017, like kind of a touch and go year in mixed martial arts in general, like arguably a down year for the UFC, a year where it was, you had some dead periods, some times when it seemed like the business was down. But for me personally, yeah, we had a child right at the beginning of April, which coincidentally is the month that we're going to talk about on this show tonight. So, and it was our third child. So we've just, my wife and I, it's just been sort of a year where we tried to keep our head above water and I personally tried to keep all of my ventures going at the same time, which is certainly a juggling act from time to time. But yeah, man, an enjoyable year on a personal level. And, toward the end of the year, it feels a little bit like the UFC is starting to pick up a little bit of momentum, I think. So we'll see what happens in 2018. Certainly a lot of unknowns out there, both for the sport and for the company that is the largest purveyor of the sport.
Very true. So for those that are joining us for the first time, this is what we do. And I invite you to go back and listen to the January through March episode that we did with Paul Fontaine. Here's what I do. I go through the archives of bloodyelbow.com every year. I go article by article. They make a nice, easy listing there, page by page, and kind of pick out some of the top headlines, top news, all the stuff we forget about because, there's so much shit that happens in any given month. And what I do is kind of organize them, filter out some of the crap, and then I pick out, okay, here's like what I think were kind of the top three storylines, events, talking points of the month, and we'll start there, and then we'll kind of go through real quickly the bullet point list to see if anything else stands out. So really in no order, we'll start with in April, UFC 210 in Buffalo, big event there with Daniel Cormier taking on Anthony Rumble Johnson in a rematch, submitting Anthony Johnson to retain the light heavyweight title and essentially clearing the path for a fight with John Jones at some point later on during the year. We obviously didn't know when that was going to happen. Cormier doing a fun promo afterward. Other notables on that card, Gegard Mousasi about to become a free agent. This is going to be kind of a trend throughout the year, guys becoming free agents and fighting out their contracts to mixed results. Beating Chris Weidman, a big knee, a little bit of controversy, I guess, at the end, but Gegard Mousasi, was sending Chris Weidman to another defeat, and there's a lot of questions about what Weidman's going to do next. There was a controversy about Pearl Gonzalez having breast implants and whether or not the state of New York would actually allow her to fight. They said that they would, but that was kind of a weird 12-hour stretch on Twitter. Cormier, if you remember, almost missed weight for this fight, and there was the whole quote-unquote Towelgate deal. Patrick Cote on the show, he retired. Anthony Johnson, speaking of him, retired after the show. And guys like Kamaru Usman and Miles Jury won, obviously setting up some good stuff for them throughout the year. So this wasn't a star-studded, one of the best events of the year, but this is a pretty solid show. And looking back on it, a lot of storylines advanced, but the big one is Daniel Cormier basically winning and again setting up this huge rematch against John Jones at some point during the rest of the year.
Yeah, UFC 210, the first trip by the UFC back to Buffalo, New York since I think 1995, right? For like UFC 7. The headlined by Ken Shamrock versus Oleg Taktarov, just to give people an idea of how long it had been since the UFC went back to Buffalo. So I think probably, and MMA itself not being legal in New York for that long, probably, especially with the Pearl Gonzalez situation, probably a sign that the State Athletic Commission was still sort of getting its ducks in a row in terms of how it was going to handle MMA moving forward. But in the main event of this show, as you said, like the beleaguered light heavyweight championship reign of Daniel Cormier takes another step with the rematch against Anthony Johnson. And in this one, you know, as I think we can expect from Cormier at this point, as a student of the game, like clearly a smart guy, a good strategist, makes it look just a little bit easier against Anthony Johnson than he had in their first fight back at UFC 187. You know, kind of weird twinning, I guess you could say, with the same sort of submission finish in this fight, but getting it in the second round instead of getting it in the third round. And another sign that Daniel Cormier, had he lived in a different era, or had he lived in a universe without the existence of John Jones, might well be recognized as the greatest light heavyweight fighter of all time. And of course, with this victory setting up the later fight at UFC 214 in July against John Jones, which is the, you know, when I look at this UFC 210 card kind of all the way around, my thoughts on all of it is sort of like, man, we had no idea what we were getting into at this point, because the Jones Cormier feud was going to take another couple of turns. This was going to end up being Musasi's last fight in the UFC, at least for now. We didn't know about that. This was the third loss for Weidman. Cynthia Calvillo was going to kind of become a thing moving on toward the end of the year. So a lot of stuff that happened at this event that was almost like foreshadowing for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and you look back at when we take a look back at these different months, and you see some of these events that at the time you really don't know what their how they're going to really affect the rest of the year. But this is one of those that really did, because obviously, you know, John Jones is at cage side, and we'd heard some stuff from him, but hadn't really seen him. And he was, I mean, him being there, I think that's they don't really do the in cage confrontations at all anymore in UFC, but him being there and kind of like, you know, just that visual, he looked good. Just, it was like, okay, this thing is really going to happen. And obviously that rematch had been on, off. And then finally it was like, okay, there's no barriers in between. There's not. However, I will say, we also had this possibility of Jones versus Anthony Johnson, which is really tantalizing because of Johnson's punching power. So I won't say we're in a can't lose situation, but we really wanted to see that DC, John Jones rematch, and then we got it. But there was this alternative that was pretty fun too. We just want to really see John Jones in there against one of these two guys, and really couldn't lose either way.
Yeah, and that's kind of the story of John Jones's recent career, right? We're sort of like in this state of suspended animation where it seems like we're eternally waiting for him to return from one setback or another to get back in there. And clearly Daniel Cormier up to this point has been his arch rival, I guess you could say, during his career, even though Jones has officially, or like technically, won both of their fights up to this point. Cormier is clearly the guy who's arguably given him his toughest tests, the guy who athletically shapes up as the most interesting pairing for John Jones. And so it's just a light heavyweight division, man. It seems like you're always in a state of, having these sort of like endless rematches, kind of like trying to cobble together Daniel Cormier versus Anthony Johnson, or like you're always sort of waiting on John Jones. And at UFC 210, we thought that the future of the division was set, that we were going to get Jones versus Cormier, and we ended up getting that at UFC 214. But again, we sort of had no idea at that point how many twists and turns this thing would take before the year was out.
Yeah, and then the aforementioned towel gate, that was kind of interesting with the him pressing down this old wrestler's trick or whatever, and lots of people complaining about that. Yeah, that was something else too.
One of the things I like about Daniel Cormier, though, and like this probably just speaks to my bias more than anything else, that I almost always side on the side of the American wrestler. You know, like I'm just kind of into the whole vibe there with the American wrestler. So Daniel Cormier, constantly looking like he just showed up from wrestling practice with his t-shirt tucked into his warm-up pants and like his socks pulled all the way up is right in my wheelhouse. And then, going out there on the scale and getting an assist from the towel, which again maybe speaks to the sort of like the work in progress status of the New York Athletic Commission also, but is sort of like just a wily veteran move from Daniel Cormier, a guy who's probably had like 1,000 amateur wrestling matches all over the world, and just sort of like, if you can take a quarter pound off the scale by even putting your hands and leaning a little bit up on the towel, why not do it? Although that's also the sort of thing where when you see a guy do it on the big stage of mixed martial arts, you figure this is one of those things that somebody can only get away with one time.
Right.
After this, no one will be able to lean on the towel ever again.
Yep. And a couple months later, we'd see that change, at least in the state of New York. And the other thing I remember coming out of this was really kind of wondering where Chris Weidman was at in his career. And after obviously the, you know, middleweight title run and just the, you know, this is kind of just decline, rapid decline. Obviously he would pick it up later in the year, but it's still kind of just a big question with him. And I think obviously the way that he lost the viciousness, obviously this was kind of like, I won't say a no doubt knockout, even though again, there was a little bit of controversy there, but you know, Musasi beat him to me, and he was in a really weird spot, and you felt for the guy because this is in his home state. He had been Mr. New York for so long, and just really couldn't seem to catch a break at this point in his career.
No, I totally agree. And with Weidman, a guy that, you know, for a couple of years there looked like he was going to be the future of the middleweight division. You know, unseated Anderson Silva at UFC 162 obviously had to come back and have the rematch with him at UFC 168. And after those two fights, even with the sort of flukish nature of the second win over Silva due to the leg injury, you thought, okay, we've got this guy, Chris Weidman, who has these really impeccable wrestling skills. He's a tremendous athlete. He's pretty good on the feet. One of the things that separates Chris Weidman from other American wrestlers is when he gets you down, he can finish you. You know, he's not like Chael Sonnen or Randy Couture in that he's probably going to take 25 minutes to just kind of grind on you. Chris Weidman is a guy who goes out there, if he puts you on the mat, he's going to tap you out or pound you out, I think, as Kelvin Gastelum found out in July of this year. But we thought Chris Weidman was sort of a passing of the torch, I guess I should say, from Anderson Silva to Chris Weidman. Mm-hmm. And then he successfully defended the title a couple of times. And then he hits this just bizarre year and a half long skid, really, where he has 3 losses in a row, all of them by KO or TKO. So like 3 kind of no doubt losses from Chris Weidman to Luke Rockhold, Yoel Romero, and finally Gegard Mousasi. And this Mousasi one, I think you're right, Josh, was sort of the one where, you know, we saw him lose this fight, even though Weidman had looked pretty capable leading up to the stoppage, where on the heels of 3 losses, you really had to think, man, what's the future now for Chris Weidman, a guy that it seemed like very recently we had thought was going to be the future of the division was now just totally cast into the unknown and into a situation where, you know, you didn't know if he was going to just be down and out kind of for the rest of his career.
So one guy that we had no doubts about as we go to our second biggest storyline or event of the month, Demetrius Johnson, UFC on Fox 24, submitting Wilson Hayes with an armbar, his 10th straight victory. This was a fight that was originally pushed back due to an injury. And yeah, Demetrius Johnson coming through in the main event for this Fox show. Robert Whittaker going on his path towards a what eventually be an interim middleweight championship shot and a victory, beating Jacare Souza with strikes. I remember I picked Sosa going into this fight just because of submission skills and maybe just a little bit of not recency bias, but just, you know, historically, I've always kind of picked him and just thought he would beat Whittaker. But Whittaker came through big wing streak, and this was a nice springboard for him. Thug Rose Namajunas, the eventual women's flyweight champion, strawweight champion, rather, defeating Michelle Watterson. And unfortunately, this we'll start there before we get into the ratings. But Demetrius Johnson, kind of quietly plugging along, doing his thing. We'd obviously see him be a lot more outspoken as the months would go on, and especially as we turned into summer. But this was just kind of another day at the office for one of the best in the world.
Yeah, and I, you know, it was kind of an important stoppage for him just because at UFC 197 back in April of 2016, he had the first round TKO over Henry Cejudo, and that was a big win for him. And we thought, okay, you know, Demetrius Johnson reaffirming his position as this dominant UFC champion, the best 125 pound fighter that we'd ever seen, the greatest flyweight of all time. And then he gets into the kind of strange fight against Tim Elliott that he had at the end of that year at the Ultimate Fighter Tournament of Champions finale, where Demetrius Johnson obviously won the unanimous decision, but the sort of like quirky style of Tim Elliott made it a more interesting fight than I think that a lot of people thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. So coming off the heels of that one against Wilson Hayes, this was one where you wanted to see Demetrius Johnson come out and look really dominating. If you know, he was going to go on being the guy that we all had assumed he was at that point. And he got that performance against Wilson Hayes for sure. You know, a very dominating, almost complete 15-minute performance that he ends with the armbar, and is another one of those performances from Demetrius Johnson where, you know, he looks so technically proficient and he looks so far ahead of his opposition that when he finally does grab that armbar in the third round, it was sort of like, you know, it kind of feels like Demetrius Johnson can do whatever he wants against these guys. And so it was up to that point, arguably his most impressive performance. And of course, a few months later against Ray Borg, he would come out and go with the highlight reel armbar submission where he tosses the guy up in the air and nabs him from behind and armbars him. But at the time, this Wilson Hayes stoppage was one where you sort of thought, wow, man, Demetrius Johnson just keeps getting better. He's so much better than everybody else in this division. Like, what's it going to take to get this guy over to kind of make him the star he deserves to be in mixed martial arts? So it was a good statement win from Demetrius Johnson and one where he just continues to look better and better and better and better than all of these other guys that the UFC can scrape together to fight him at 125 pounds.
Yeah, and I think and I've talked about this on this podcast before is that I think with Johnson, I don't think it's a lack of promotion. I think it's just a lack of competitive fights. And I think the fights that you tend to look at other, you know, you tweet other people, text other people, whatever, and just like, wow, you got to watch this, or you keep seeing this. Those things that just that we know in looking at fights like, you know, John Jones versus Gustafson. And, you know, some of those moments where all of a sudden every the world just kind of goes away and you're just locked in whatever you're watching and being like, wow, I have no idea how this is going to turn out. And you just you see the best of both guys, and this isn't, you know, it really sucks for Johnson because it's just he's just so much better than everyone else, and that's the hope is that some of these guys coming behind him will get a chance to kind of, you know, really form and can come together and be at that spot. Like Cejudo got that shot about a year too early. He should have been have more and more fights, but that's just, you know, it's just the way that the division goes. Ray Borg probably is the same case. I mean, there's guys that just they don't have. He needs challenges, and that's, you know, he's just too good. It's just this weird kind of conundrum he's in where he's so good and needs fights, but the guys coming behind him don't have the time to really get ready. But even if they do, he makes it look easy. And this is you know, he keeps doing it on this platform of Big Fox. And I mean, he's just. He'll never be to me like a big pay-per-view star or anything like that. I think that ship has sailed. But you know, if I would love, and I think that's why the TJ fight was so tantalizing for people, is that there seemed to be a legitimate challenge there. You know, and I think that'd be kind of the fun thing. He went up to 135. That could be a fun thing as well. But it sounds like he's just going to keep doing what he's doing, and I guess we're just going to have to be happy with the results no matter what they are.
Yeah, and you know, Demetrius Johnson is a weird puzzle at this point because. You talk to the guy, you get him in an interview setting. He's terrific. He spits fire the whole time. He's a smart guy. He's obviously so advanced in terms of his all around technical game and his ability to pick apart opponents and to kind of, you know, take every guy and come up with the strategy along with Matt Hume out there in Seattle, to come up with the exact right game plan to take everybody apart. He's kind of everything you want in a mixed martial arts fighter. So it seems strange that the culture at large, or at least like the kind of casual mainstream fan has been so slow to embrace him because inside the MMA bubble, if you're a hardcore guy, Demetrius Johnson is sort of like a must watch fighter. Even if the fights that he's in don't turn out to be all that competitive. You got to watch him just because you never know when he's going to throw Ray Borg up in the air and armbar him. You never know when he's going to armbar Wilson Hayes or TKO Henry Cejudo in the first round, or you know, dance circles around John Dodson for five rounds. It's a real conundrum, I think, in the sport, because he's one of those guys that could well be both the greatest of all time, you know, at 125. And I think you can make the argument one of the greatest of all times at any weight. And yet the fight consuming public at large just seems so slow to embrace the guy. And you're right that, like, the idea of a fight with TJ Dillashaw at any weight, regardless of where they were going to do it, just seemed, so cool because Demetrius Johnson in his own right was a pretty good bantamweight back before the flyweight division existed. So there's a lot of interest, I think, around that fight. I hope that they can still kind of make it work. I would still love to see them do that, especially now, because you think about Demetrius Johnson sort of soldiering on at flyweight, and I'm not sure, you know, what's still out there for him. A rematch with Henry Cejudo, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing that's certainly going to move the needle any more than anything that he's already done.
And I'm looking at the rest of this, kind of the main points from this, this card. It reminds me of in UFC in November at Madison Square Garden, where it seemed like everyone said, you know, the prevailing theme, or one of them, was that the good guys won, you know, Rose won, TJ won, and George St. Pierre won, and kind of the non trash talkers, or just the good guys, so to speak. And you look at the winners on the show and what they would go on to do, you know, Demetrius Johnson, Robert Whittaker, and Thug Rose. And obviously Thug Rose would win that title later in the year, but it seemed like this show, this was just this, and the show did not do great ratings overnight. And maybe there's some sort of correlation there with what people want to see, but this was one where this group is kind of marching towards history in their own way later on in the year. And it was kind of pushing out some of the, I don't want to say the older start, but Jacare, obviously, I think probably his best days are behind him. Wilson Hayes, obviously, he's an older fighter. You know, Michelle Watterson's kind of like, I think we know she's not miscast, but probably in the wrong weight division, and just, a good, someone that can compete, but compete at that upper level, probably not going to happen there. But you had this next group kind of saying, okay, now it's our turn to take this year over. So looking back on this was a some foreshadowing for the rest of the year.
Yeah, kind of like UFC 210 in that regard. And especially for Robert Whittaker, I feel like, you know, coming out and not only beating Jacare Souza, but stopping him, you know, this was sort of like a statement win for Robert Whittaker, because we had seen the guy against sort of like the mid-range talent at middleweight. You know, we'd seen him against Uriah Hall. We'd seen him against Derek Brunson. We'd seen him against Brad Tavares, that kind of level of competition. And then he fights Jacare, who has been a perennial contender at this division and the former Strikeforce champion. So to come out and beat Jacare Souza was definitely Robert Whittaker kind of planting a flag in the sand to say, hey, you know, I'm for real. I'm here. I'm one of the elite fighters at 185 pounds. And then clearly he goes on to, just reiterate that point by defeating Yoel Romero at UFC 213 and winning the interim middleweight title. And again, at UFC on Fox, we didn't know how twisted the tail was going to get yet, but eventually gets promoted to undisputed champion. And now, kind of staring down the barrel of this matchup with Luke Rockhold, which obviously hasn't happened yet, but is just sort of, you know, the kind of fight that makes you feel like we've moved on to sort of the next generation of the middleweight division. So a big, big night for Robert Whittaker here, just letting everybody know that he was going to be a problem moving forward for almost anybody that he fought.
Yeah. Let's go over the rest of this list. I had been on the border. There wasn't like, so I put USC Nashville as my number three, even though I was really kind of with that, because There wasn't a ton of big things that happened, but we'll kind of go over the list and kind of react to some of this stuff as we go through it. So USC Nashville, obviously Cub Swanson defeating Artem Lobov in a decision victory there. Very strange main event in a lot of ways because of Lobov just not really being that big of a draw. Just other basically known as being Conor McGregor's buddy, and Cub Swanson using this as a showcase to get a victory and make a claim for a big fight for him later on. Ally Aquinta being Diego Sanchez in 98 seconds. That was obviously notable because, you know, obviously what happened to Sanchez later in the year. And then Mike Perry, who I find to be a lot of fun, and I think a lot of other people do, a vicious knockout of Jake Ellenberger on the show. And then Joe Lauzon going down defeat to Stevie Ray. Brock Lesnar defeated Bill Goldberg at WrestleMania in what is really the fight of the year. I think everyone could agree with that. UFC Singapore got Holly Holm versus Betchka Hay as its main event. We found out that RDA, Rafael Dos Anjos, very fitting, we just talked about him, going to make his welterweight debut against Tarek Saffiedine at that show. We learned that UFC 213 was going to get the rivalry of Cody Garbrandt versus TJ Dillashaw, and also, drool alert, Donald Cerrone versus Robbie Lawler. We're very excited about that. We also learned that Robbie Lawler loves John Cena. Out of all the things I learned this year in a very strange 2017, that one stood out for sure. We didn't have to wait too long to find out when Jones and DC were going to rematch. That was going to happen at, obviously, UFC 214. No tune-up fight. That whole thing got thrown out the window, so no, DC versus Jimmy Manoa or anything like that. So that rematch is going to happen. Bellator announced they're going to host small MMA shows during NASCAR weekend events, of all places. I've heard nobody ever talk about any of these fights ever, other than talking about maybe the conditions backstage where these guys were warming up, which is pretty bad, so take that for what you will. Kelvin Gastelum was flagged by USADA for marijuana use, and his fight with Anderson Silva at UFC 212 was off. Frank Mir was suspended for 2 years after a failed USADA test. This was a retroactive retroactive penalty. So obviously he was going to be on the shelf for quite some time. The ongoing chatter about Floyd versus Connor sounded like it was going to become a little bit of a reality, and that was it kind of just started to sink in April and even more so in May. But again, this ongoing talk about this fight and something we thought was never going to happen was eventually going to happen. Speaking of Conor McGregor, there was a story about a hotel room he trashed and had to get professionally cleaned, being filled with laughing gas containers. He did, however, make Time's 100 Most Influential People of the Year, so take that for what it is. Uriah Faber has announced he is going to be inducted in the UFC Hall of Fame. Bellator had a few events during the month with Rafael Carvalho defeating Melvin Manhoff by fourth-round TKO in a rematch of what was probably the worst fight I've ever seen. Bellator 177, Eduardo Dantas beat Leandro Higo in a split decision with a title, Dantas' bantamweight title, not on the line. And then at Bellator 178, Patricky Pitbull, I believe, submitting Daniel Strauss to reclaim the 145-pound title in their fourth meeting. Ryan Bader versus Phil Davis was set for Bellator 190 for the light heavyweight title as King Mo dropped out of a fight with Bader due to injury. So Ryan Bader's first fight in Bellator was going to be for the championship. Val Letourneau signed with Bellator. Dana White returned to form, taking on Luke Rockhold, Gegard Mousasi, Jeff Mayweather, Bob Arum, and anyone else who would dare cross him. So he was back, not being quiet, yelling at everyone he could, and calling people out. So that was fun, all across the combat sports spectrum. Ally Aquinta decided to declare himself the UFC president and decided to go after Dana White publicly. Clearly does not like the UFC brass and let people know about it. Jacare Souza re-upped with UFC for 8 fights, which was pretty crazy. Mauro Moraes signed with the UFC after a long run in World Series of Fighting and got up his first date against Rafael Sunsau at UFC 212. We learned a little bit about Lady Cyborg's future, as it will be in doubt, because she had an October contract deadline, which she had a certain amount of fights she needed to get in, and there was no indication of when she was going to fight or who she was going to fight, so it's a question about her becoming a free agent. There's a lot of talk about a fight fix in UFC Seoul at an event that happened earlier. It was 2016, I believe, and it was, it wasn't a lot talked about this, but this was something that was being investigated. World Series Fighting announced they were going to change their name and move to a league format with the Professional Fighters League coming in 2018. Miguel Torres, longtime WEC star and the purveyor of a few unfortunate jokes about rape bans, decided to retire. Ronda Rousey, sorry fellas, getting engaged to Travis Brown. Tough debuted with a Cody Garbrandt versus TJ Dillashaw choking sequence. That was quite something. Maurice Smith was announced he was going to be in the UFC Hall of Fame, and UFC announced they were heading to Edmonton for the very first time ever for UFC 216. And that wraps up a pretty interesting April. What of that list stood out to you?
Oh, man, so much stuff. You know, like we talked kind of this whole conversation about foreshadowing for what would happen later. I think you look back at Conor McGregor trashing a hotel room full of laughing gas containers and having to, you know, pay to have it cleaned. And now with what we've seen from him since then, in the wake of his loss to Floyd Mayweather in their much talked about mega hyped super fight boxing match, it just kind of makes you wonder, huh? Well, Conor McGregor was sort of like taking baby steps toward these other things that we would see from him, just in terms of, you know, being caught on camera using the homophobic slur with Artem Lobov, and then jumping into the cage at the Bellator event in Dublin and getting into it with Mark Goddard, and then having this thing now where it's rumored that he is in some kind of a feud with underworld types over there in Ireland. So like just to flash back to April and say, huh, sounds like Conor McGregor had a pretty crazy hotel room party, just kind of makes you feel like, okay, again, we had no idea where this story was going, but it's sort of like a little bit of a clue as to what we were going to talk about with Conor McGregor for, you know, the rest of the year, and then moving on toward New Year's here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think anything else that really stood out for me, I think the let's see. Obviously, we're getting a lot of fights set up for the summer, and some would obviously fall through, but I think we're kind of getting an idea of what was to come. And just as weird, you know, again, Dana White's relationship with fighters and kind of looking through some of the stuff he was talking about complaining, because Luke Rockhold obviously was complaining about the 185-pound belt and what was going on with Bisping and this whole GSP thing and all that stuff. And he was being very vocal. And obviously, he was starting to get into it with the boxing people as well, because there was just this constant thing as far as like, you know, how much all these crazy numbers about, like, you know, I don't know if this was at the time, but Mayweather was going to, you know, $25 million would be a great deal. And it just was kind of throwing out all these things out there to kind of stay relevant as we were kind of marching towards this this eventual fight that was going to be signed. But it seemed like a lot of public posturing for something we didn't think was going to happen. But he was just kind of going off on anyone. And this was, this is really kind of the summer of the build towards this event, which just got so much bigger than anyone could have imagined. It was kind of fun to kind of look back and see some of the little things that happened throughout the year. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned like the laughing gas stuff. That just seems tame compared to what the stories right later on in the month for McGregor's crazy stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And Dana White kind of seems like, you know, like we said at the top of the show, arguably sort of a down year for the UFC. And maybe, you know, you get into the springtime of the new WME IMG era, and it kind of felt like Dana White started to assert himself a little bit more, started to become more of the public figure that we had known him to be a few years ago, where he was sort of like the firebrand UFC president. And I think you're right. It does seem like April, May was a real turning point for Conor McGregor versus Floyd Mayweather, where people started, it went from being like a crazy internet meme to sort of being a thing that all of the principals began to believe could actually happen. And so, yeah, looking back on it, sort of like springtime getting underway kind of seems, in retrospect, like bigger things were happening than maybe we thought at the time.
Yeah. Final question. How will you look? Obviously, we have one more event left to go in for the UFC. How are you going to look back at 2017? What's going to be your standout moment in memory?
Wow. I don't know that we had one single standout moment in 2017 aside from Mayweather McGregor. Clearly, that was sort of like a one-off mega fight that felt like the only time we were ever going to see something like that happen. So I think, you know, years from now we'll look back on 2017 and look at that boxing match. But for the UFC, like I said, it felt like kind of a if not an off year, kind of like an inconsistent year where we had the Jon Jones stuff happen. We had his fight with Daniel Cormier turned into a no contest, which kind of put a sour note on what should have been a great light heavyweight feud and one of the all-time, you know, UFC kind of blood feud things. But it does feel like the company is starting to pick up a little steam toward the end of the year. We've had a couple of, you know, if not blockbuster sellers, UFC pay-per-views that featured a lot of good fights. And now we're going to cruise into the end of the year with Holly Holm versus Chris Cyborg, which feels like it could be another kind of, for at least for hardcore fans, a really competitive fight and a fight where maybe the two best 145 pound women in the world are going to tangle on the feet. And so it was a year that I feel like the mixed martial arts world in general started to feel a lot more unstable than maybe we had thought it was going to. And I think moving into 2018, it raises a lot of questions about where the sport is going, where the UFC is going, where the WME IMG ownership group is going, you know, where the TV rights are going. We have a lot of unanswered questions as we finish this year and verge into 2018, whether Conor McGregor will be back, whether Brock Lesnar will ever be back, whether Ronda Rousey will ever be back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, it for a sport that maybe 7 years ago felt like it was really about to kind of take over the world. I feel like closing out 2017 kind of makes me wonder, you know, where is this whole thing going, which is, I don't want to say unsettling, but like a weird place that I didn't necessarily know we were going to find ourselves this far into the UFC's march to the quote unquote mainstream.
Are you a Stranger Things fan?
Yeah, for sure.
So if 2016 was the real world, 2017 feels like the upside down, doesn't it?
It kind of did. Yeah. It kind of does.
Yeah. And I don't know what I don't know what is looming over our high school, at that snowball dance, but I'm hoping we get back to the regular world for 2018.
I like it, man.
All right. Well, you can, read him on Bleacher Report, obviously hear him every single week on the Co-Made Event podcast, and, obviously pick up his book, Champion of the World, available at finer booksellers everywhere, including Amazon.com. Makes a great Christmas gift, as Chuck Mendenhall noted in a great tweet last week. Anything else to plug coming up?
No, I think that covers it. We'll be rolling out to the end of the year with the Co-Main Event podcast, and just going to kind of keep doing all my stuff moving on towards 2018 here.
Yeah, it's coming up on us really quick, and we obviously wish you and the family happy holidays, happy Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate, Kwanzaa, anything like that. Chad Dundas, we wish you the best this holiday season.
Oh, I appreciate it, Josh. Thanks for having me, as always.
So we continue our look back at the year that was 2017. I'm glad to have one of my favorite guests of the past year on me this week. You know him as a voice of all types of combat sports, boxing, MMA, a little bit of pro wrestling here and there in his past. He's a fan, as you know. A little bit of writing, podcasting, all the good stuff. He's a man of many talents. Sean Wheelock returns back to Josh Nason's Punch-Out. And Sean, we were just talking before the, off-air, as the pros say, about the holidays coming up, and you're finally getting a little bit of time off the road and getting a chance to enjoy some time at home and rest the pipe, so to speak.
Yeah, this has been a very interesting year for me. This has been my favorite professional year since 2010, which was my first year with Bellator when it was all Bjorn Rebney, and it kind of felt like us against the world, and that was a great year, and this is my favorite year since then. I've had a lot of cool opportunities. I do Victory on Fight Pass. I do M1 in Europe, so I've been to Russia 12 times this year. I was in Finland. I was in China. I do a boxing series in Mexico for CBS Sports Network. So it's been a lot of fun. So I'm on Christmas break, which feels a lot like being on summer break when you're a kid. So just sitting around hanging out with my kids and my family and my wife and just enjoying the time off. And then check back with me in about a week and a half. I'll be ready to go back on the road.
So you 12 trips to Russia. Have you do you expect to be depositioned by anyone in the State Department or anything?
It's very interesting because I have a 3-year Russian visa and I have a 10-year Chinese visa in my passport. So I keep waiting, but for whatever reason, it seems like I'm looked at more when I come back from the boxing series in Mexico. Read into that what you will, but usually with Russia, I skate back through. I did have one immigration officer just asking me, he had no idea who I was or MMA, what do you do? I'm a television commentator. What sport's MMA? He said, yeah, who fought in your main event? And I told him, and he said, okay. I thought I could have made up any Russian names, and he wouldn't let me through, but I think they look for the reaction. But it's really a magnificent country. I first went to Russia, my first stint with M1 before Bellator in 2008, and I loved it then, and I love it even more now. It really feels like, and all my Russian friends, the fighters and the people I work with at M1 and the journalists, I tell them it feels like Russia has moved forward about 25 or 30 years in the last 9 years. Mm-hmm. It's really a marvelous country. I can't say enough good things about it. And this year I went to 7 different Russian cities. You go to the big places like St. Petersburg and Moscow. I was in Orenburg, which is a World Cup city, absolutely gorgeous. I was in Sochi that had the 2014 Winter Olympics, which is one of the 2 or 3 most spectacular places I've been to in my life. Ingushetia twice, including over American Thanksgiving, which is in southern Russia. It's near Azerbaijan. Just really amazing places. And I still don't lose sight of the fact that I'm a guy from Shawnee, Kansas, who gets to go to all these really cool places. I feel extremely fortunate.
Hmm. Is there one country that you have not broadcasted in that is kind of on your bucket list?
I'd love to go to New Zealand, and right now as we speak, I think I have 480,000 miles in my American Airlines account.
Wow.
And my wife and I always talk about going to New Zealand. My girls are 6 and 12. I think my 12-year-old could do the flight, and we live in Kansas City, so just to get on the flight to New Zealand, which is flying to L.A., so for me on American, that would be Kansas City to Dallas or Phoenix and then on to L.A. That might be enough travel for a 6-year-old, but New Zealand, everyone tells me who's been there, it's a spectacular country. The Kiwis who I've met in my life are amazing people. That's where I would love to go. But places where I always wanted to go, I've been really fortunate to be there. Like Russia was a country I always wanted to go to. I always wanted to go to Brazil. I've been there. I wanted to go to South Africa. I've been there. But New Zealand, that's the one country I'm looking forward to. If I get a fight opportunity, that's great. If not, I'll probably take my family on holiday one of these days. But at 6 years old, that's a long flight from Kansas City. That's a lot of travel.
I can imagine. Let's go to 2 months we're going to focus on here. We had Chad Dundas join us for April as we kind of look back at Q2, kind of this process here. So we start in May, and again we kind of go through the top events and happenings and storylines and all that stuff of the month, and there two stood out for sure in May. And I guess we'll start with a out of cage series of news and happenings that is kind of a head scratcher in a lot of ways. But so see if you can follow this. So Dana White said that George St. Pierre versus Michael Bisping, the fight was off. We had no date or anything like that, location or anything like that understood for the fight. Then all of a sudden it was announced, okay, Yoel Romero is going to fight Michael Bisping for the title next. Then later it became an interim title fight between Robert Whittaker and Yoel Romero.
Right.
And then the title fight, it was possible. They said it was possible, and then it was booked for UFC 213, so that became reality. GSP later revealing he had an eye injury and that he wasn't ever planning on fighting during the summer, and the UFC knew this. And all during the time, Michael Bisping said, I have no idea what's going on. So this was a dance between trying to make this GSP-Bisping fight happen one way or another. And the title just kind of like, well, we don't know. We really want to make this for the championship, so we'll just make an interim title. And then this, we thought we were going to get Romero Bisping. It was just a dance between all these parties that kind of happened over the first the first few weeks of the month of May. And we finally got somewhat of a resolution, but it was just they were hell bent on making this GSP Bisping fight, but also kind of keeping the middleweight division going as well.
Yeah, it's something that I think bothers more and more fight fans, and one of those fight fans is Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, who's leading the charge out of Congress to extend the Muhammad Ali Boxing Reform Act into MMA. And he actually cited in the last congressional hearings, which Randy Couture was a part of, Mark Ratner, my friend, got really roughed up in those hearings from the UFC. They made the rounds on the internet. If people didn't see them, you can see them on YouTube. But Congressman Mullen, who is a congressman, a U.S. representative in the House out of Oklahoma, was actually a pro MMA fighter, wrestled with Bobby Lashley at Missouri Valley College, huge fight fan. And he talked about this very situation, why the Ali Reform Act needs to go to MMA. Now, I'm not going to talk politics, whether I think it does or it doesn't, but I will say that, that these are the machinations that bother a lot of people. It's almost like if you're the UFC, if you want to make the fight, just make the fight. But jumping people through hoops and it's an interim title, I think that's what bothers a lot of us fight fans, Josh. I'm sure you probably feel the same way. Look, the UFC controls their own belts, just like everyone in MMA does. And I think to the casual observer, your audience certainly knows this, you obviously know this, my friend, that we don't have the WBC and the WBA and the IBF and the WBO and the USBA and the NABF and on like they do in boxing. So there aren't sanctioning bodies. And whatever problems there are with sanctioning bodies in boxing, and there are many, they just simply don't exist. That's just an unknown concept in MMA. Starting with the great Art Davey with UFC 1, it was, we're going to control our own titles, and it's the pro wrestling model. WWE controls their own titles. When I was a kid watching NWA wrestling in Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas, the NWA controlled those titles, and then at that regional level, Bob Geigel, Pat O'Connor, and Harley Race controlled the Central States titles. And, you know, even though it's not kayfabe, they're obviously shoots and not works, it's the same model. So when you look at that situation, to me, it's absolutely ridiculous. Look, George St. Pierre, arguably the greatest fighter of all time and arguably one of the greatest fighters of all time. Where you place him on your greatest list, he's on there somewhere. The reality, though, is he's been retired, and he's not an 85er. So he comes out of retirement into a new weight class, and he immediately fights for the title. Now, fair enough, he won. But again, you're going through a lot of these very odd machinations. Robert Whittaker is phenomenal. Luke Rockhold, Jacare, Yoel Romero. I mean, it is a stacked division. You know, Gegard Mousasi went to Bellator. I think Alexander Shlemenko, despite that loss to Mousasi, is a world-class 85er. Rafael Carvalho in Bellator. There are some amazing 85ers out there. And as great as St. Pierre is, no one said he's an amazing 85er. He's an amazing 70 or an amazing fighter. It just shows really and clearly how transparent it is with the UFC when they want to make a title fight. For me, if you want to end the charade, just make the fight. But to say, oh, this is an interim and this is an eliminator and we'll do that, this, and he was injured, and that's what I think really turns the fans off.
One thing I've talked about on previous shows, and this has obviously been talked about a lot, is the weird relationship between Dana White and GSP, and considering one of your top, one of the guys that really, really basically was the front runner in Canada in terms of just, he was the face, you know, he was the guy that crossed over and was a mega star, and just this whole process just really wasn't treated with that much respect. And obviously it's the fight game. So, you know, and dealing with Dana White, sometimes that respect where it just doesn't apply. But for a guy like with GSP, it just seems like they were just kind of like, you know, I want to say not throwing him under the bus, but really just not doing him any favors, I guess. And this was kind of another idea. And this whole thing of, you know, GSP saying that his eye was hurt, he wasn't going to fight in the summer anyway. So it's just kind of that they kept putting him in weird spots where he would have to basically defend why he wasn't fighting. When meanwhile, the guy on the other end, Bisping's just kind of like, he doesn't know what's going on, but he's talking about all kinds of injuries. Just very strange situation still, even to this day, between GSP and the UFC.
No, I agree. And I think if you look at the history of the UFC, since the Zuffa regime came in, which was December 2000 into January 2001, in the emergence of Dana White, and obviously Dana White's still there, even though the Fertittas are out and it's WMEIMG, there seems like there are sometimes very kind of odd, contentious relationships with the biggest stars. I mean, look no further than Chris Cyborg, headlining the show on December 30th. Randy Couture, non-UFC Hall of Fame, didn't even get the corner license when his son Ryan was still fighting for the UFC before he went to Bellator. The relationship with Frank Shamrock, even Stipe Miocic, Art Davey and I, we speak every day, and 2 days ago we were talking about Stipe Miocic. Like, what more does this guy have to do? Why doesn't he get a promotional push? Maybe the UFC sees it differently, but you wonder. And then when you have your biggest stars, and George St. Pierre is obviously one of the biggest stars, whether he's retired or fighting, inactive, active, 185, 170, champion, not champion, he's one of the biggest stars. And he's a rare, still rare in MMA crossover star to where the general sports fan knows who he is. And I agree with you fully. It seems like it's contentious, and you wonder why. I don't know if it's because they're pushing for more money or more fighters' rights, or they're not someone who's just going to happily fight for $25,000 and $25,000, but you wonder why there's not more of a promotional push. this is, I think, what's going to really define this upcoming era of the UFC, which is going to start with a new television contract, which really is going to be the true WME-IMG era, is how does the UFC deal with their biggest stars? If you look at other organizations, not individual sports, but other organizations like the National Football League, for instance, or Major League Baseball, how do they deal with their biggest stars? How does the ATP Tour in tennis or the PGA in golf, how do they deal with their biggest stars? NASCAR, the English Premier League. And I think you have to look at what's going to happen under the new TV deal, where there's presumably going to be a lot more than the $700 million that's being generated by the current Fox deal. It's definitely going to be over $1 billion. How high we'll see, maybe, what, $1.4 to $1.6 billion in TV revenue? How not only the top fighters are paid, but how they're treated. Is there that perceived contentious issue? Are fighters who you think should be getting a promotional push not? And I just met Paige VanZant last weekend when I was doing Victory on Fight Pass. Spectacular person. My buddy John McCarthy has always told me she's great, and I'll back that up. But I know there are a lot of fighters who look and say, why did Paige VanZant get the promotional push, and why not Chris Cyborg? Now, I know a lot of listeners are going to say, I know why. But in the big picture, you have to ask that. Or Sage Northcutt. I mean, there's some obvious answers that you can give, but on a deeper level, why are certain fighters given a push, certain fighters not? And it'll be interesting to see what happens with the new TV deal, this new money, and then what happens with some of these older bedrock stars like George St. Pierre moving forward. Because whatever you say about the UFC right now, they're short on emerging talent. They have phenomenal fighters, and guys like you and me and people who listen to your show, we're all fight people, so we get it. But the person who is a very casual MMA fan, they would be hard-pressed to name a lot of emerging stars. And I always think about this. In any sport, individual team does not matter. In any sport, if your most famous athletes are retired, that's not a great sign. And when you look at MMA right now, and specifically look at the UFC, who their biggest stars are right now, a lot of them are retired or inactive, if you think about that. Yeah. Randy Couture, Ronda Rousey, Misha Tate. It's not great. John Jones, I know he's not retired, but he's certainly active. We'll see the contract of George St. Pierre and what he does moving forward. But you always have to keep reinventing yourself. You have to keep bringing in new stars.
You mentioned Stipe Miocic earlier, and he headlines my second biggest story of the month, and that was In Cage, UFC 211. Good event that happened in Dallas. Stipe Miocic, the heavyweight champion of the world, obviously, knocking out Jury Dos Santos in a pretty fun scrap that they had. Obviously, Miocic was fairly dominant in one-sided fight, but still dispatching JDS for the defense of his championship. And we obviously would not see him until, well, we're going to actually see him next month in Boston. But however, you know, with Stipe winning, retaining his title, we had a disappointing no-contest ending to Eddie Alvarez and Dustin Poirier, a fight that we're still hoping to see again at some point in 2018, even though Eddie's playing a little bit hard to get. Uranian Jacek successfully defending her strawweight title against Jessica Andrade in a pretty one-sided fashion. Frankie Edgar's on this show dominated. The young lion, Yair Rodriguez, makes staking his claim for a fight at a championship fight at 145. And also Damian Maia earning a title shot win with a split decision over Jorge Masvidal. You know, when you look back in the show, a lot of interesting results on the show, and obviously setting up some big things later on the year. Obviously, Stipe, this started a little bit of a contract dispute with UFC that wouldn't see him in the cage for the rest of the year. But, you know, you look at Alvarez Poirier and kind of what that was, and, you know, Yanadin and Jacek, Frankie Edgar. You know, there were interesting results, but some of these, we didn't really kind of get the completion of some of their stories, especially with Miocic and Edgar.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk about Eddie Alvarez, too. And, you know, I knew Eddie Alvarez. He signed his Bellator contract at 09. I became the commentator and signed my contract in 2010. And I like Eddie Alvarez a lot. And that was his first fight coming back after the Conor McGregor loss, which was a very difficult loss for him. It's never fun to be someone else's highlight. And so many people really saw that as the definitive Conor McGregor performance. It was a bad night for Eddie Alvarez. I'm not saying Eddie Alvarez wins again if they rematch, but I think he would fight a better fight. So the Poirier fight obviously ended in controversy. You know, Eddie Alvarez is still phenomenal. I mean, just look at the Justin Gaethje fight. I know you want to focus on that, but this, but Alvarez is still phenomenal. But it was an unfortunate situation in that bout. And with Joanna Jędrzejczyk, you know, coming off of that performance and in that fight, people are saying, you know, she's the next big star. This is the one. Why it's never Chris Cyborg, who knows, because I think Chris Cyborg is phenomenal as a fighter and as a person. And as we go into this December 30th fight, we'll see. But Jędrzejczyk really, really rising up, only, obviously, to lose her title as the year progressed. And when you were saying on Stipe Miocic, and I'll follow up on that too, what I was saying earlier, Josh, is what more does this guy have to do? You talked about a contract dispute, but he's an EMS. He's a family man. He's from Ohio. He was a college wrestler. Is it because, and when I was doing my podcast with Ben Askren and Joe Warren, we talked about this. If his name were, say, Stephen Mills instead of Stipe Miocic, you know, Joe Warren actually laughed that he thought for like the first few years of Stipe's career that he was born in Croatia or born in Serbia or Slovenia.
Yeah.
That he didn't realize that the guy was from Ohio. And I don't know, maybe it's like a Larry Holmes syndrome where Larry Holmes, because he followed Ali, he never got the credit he deserved. And maybe because there's not been that Ali-type performer, but maybe because Stipe Miocic comes out of that wave that follows Randy Couture and then Brock Lesnar, that he's just not seen as that great. But I think the guy is a phenomenal fighter. We talked about promotional pushes. I don't know why he's not getting that, but Stipe Miocic has clearly shown himself to be the best heavyweight in the UFC, and I would certainly say the best heavyweight in the sport. Vitaly Minnikov would be number two for me right now, fighting for EFN in Russia, but Miocic is phenomenal. It is so difficult, as history shows, to keep winning and winning as a heavyweight. Igor Vovchanchin did it, Fedor Emelianenko did it, but those are really different eras. When you look at even dominant heavyweights of the past 10 to 12 years, the losses come pretty quickly, and sometimes they can pile up. And Stipe Miocic has been in an incredible run of form, and he's just, for whatever reason, not gotten that promotional push. You know, I really wonder if you walk down the street tomorrow, Josh, and you just found some rando people in a sports bar, and you said, do you know who Randy Couture is? They'd probably say, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Do you know Ronda Rousey is? Oh, yeah. Conor McGregor? Yeah, 100%. Stipe Miocic? I'm not sure that they would know. And if they did, how many know that he's actually from Cleveland? And as I said, not from Serbia.
So there's two things with this. One is I think if Cain Velasquez had not been injured this year and they were able to make that fight happen in, say, you know, September or July or something like that, and say Stipe runs through Cain and wins, or even in a classic heavyweight fight, whatever you want to do, as long as Stipe wins at the end, I think that perception changes a little bit. I think that, you know, wins over kind of other – he's obviously had some big wins. Obviously, Overeem is a big enough name. But you think of guys like a Cain would almost kind of be a passing of the torch there. And I think people are kind of waiting to see that fight. And then we'll see what happens in January against Ngannou. I mean, if he was able to down Ngannou, who's just this, you know, this force that is just
right,
coming and coming and coming – I wonder maybe if that narrative changes a little bit for him going into this next year. I mean, and again, if he beats Ngannou and then say the Cain fight is just kind of sitting there, if Cain's healthy and able to do that, which is always a risky proposition, I wonder if maybe then it's like, okay, he's all, at that point he'll have set the consecutive UFC heavyweight title defense record, and then I wonder if it's kind of like, well, he's beat the best we got. Who's left? Brock Lesnar, you know, as far as trying to get him
right,
over.
Right.
I wonder if that'll help.
Yeah, no, I think you are absolutely right in what you were saying. And so often in combat sports, be it MMA or boxing or kickboxing, Muay Thai, doesn't matter, you need those career-defining wins. I think boxing, for whatever reason, lends itself to it the most, where name any boxer ever, and people are going to say, oh, my God, the so-and-so fight. You know, if you talk about Larry Holmes, a lot of people are going to talk about when he beat Ali, even though Ali was at the end of his career. If you talk about Ali, people are going to talk about the Foreman fight in 74. They're going to talk about the Joe Frazier trilogy. You know, with Mike Tyson, a lot of people are going to talk about that knockout of Michael Spinks in the first round. There are those career-defining victories. Lennox Lewis, they'll talk about Tyson. If you talk about Sugar Ray Leonard, they might talk about the No Moss fight against Roberto Duran, or about the Tommy Hearns fight, that you're blowing it, son, you're blowing it, that Angelo Dundee said to him. There are those career-defining wins. And maybe with Stipe Miocic, he doesn't have that. Look, you and I know, or your listeners know, that Overeem's a great win, but Overeem also loses a lot. And I don't know if there's the perception from the casual fan, and so much of this is shaped by the perception, not of us hardcores, but of the casual fan. As big and as tough and as intimidating as Overeem can be, he has lost a lot, and he's not a fighter that generally puts together long, consistent winning streaks. He'll have a phenomenal, dominant performance. He might win again, and then he might get finished in a fight, and that's Overeem. And I don't think Miocic was given credit fully for that victory. So if it's Ngannou, I think that's very possible. We'll see, but Ngannou might change it in his favor. But, you know, I think a lot of it, too, goes to a company wanting to give a promotion, wanting to give a promotional push. You know, if a sponsor comes and says, can you give us the name of an athlete? We want to put them in this campaign or this 30-second commercial or do this photo shoot. Who is the UFC saying right now? Are they saying Stipe Miocic or are they saying Sage Northcutt? I don't know.
Let's go over the rest of the month, and after I kind of run through this list, we'll see if any of these stand out to you as things you might remember or interested in or so on. We'll no particular order. We'll start with Rory McDonald. Was dominant in his Bellator debut over Paul Daly. If you guys remember, Paul Daly, an MVP, then went at it in the stands. That was an interesting kind of night there for Bellator, and we learned that McDonald will, of course, fight for the welterweight title, and that fight is coming up in January as well. MVP, speaking of him, he was injured and out of that show. UFC Stockholm, Gustafsson. Alexander Gustafsson is back, returned form, knocking out Glover Teixeira in round 5 in a very fun fight and looking like he would be should be the next in the line for a light heavyweight championship fight, except he got injured later in the year, but looked fantastic after a long, long layoff. And also one of the big surprises of the year, Volkan Ozdemir, knocking out Mirka Serkanov in just 28 seconds. And also afterwards, Alexander Gustafsson proposed to his girlfriend in the octagon. Always nice for the ladies to have that happen. More and more Mayweather-McGregor buzz, with Dana White saying that they had lost the date that they were going to plan to have this fight for Triple G and Canelo. He also said there was just a lot of public posturing. He set a deadline for this fight to happen. Then later saying, we found out that, quote-unquote, Conor and I have agreed on our side of the equation. McGregor decided to apply for a Nevada boxing license. Then Dana White saying, McGregor may never fight again after this. And Oscar De La Hoya, to no big surprise, did not like any of this. UFC announced their 12th weight class, and they were going to have a new women's flyweight champion that's going to be settled on a new season of The Ultimate Fighter. Of course, when they made the announcement, they then tried to rescind the announcement because it went out too early, and then they admitted that, of course, it was happening like we all figured. Justin Gaethje, you mentioned him earlier. He finally signed with the UFC. A lot of excitement about that. It was promptly booked against Michael Johnson in the Tough 25 headliner later this summer. Calvin Gastelum's win over Vitor Belfort was made a no contest due to a positive test for marijuana. Chuck Liddell, speaking of retired fighters, not ruling out a comeback at this point. We talk about him a little bit more later in the summer. Nate Diaz, always kind of wondering when he might come back, said he was not interested in fighting for a quote-unquote fake UFC title or fighting Eddie Alvarez or anything like that. So they were trying to book both Diaz brothers, but neither guy was that interested. Anderson Silva was not happy. Threatened retirement if he didn't get an interim fight with Yoel Romero that summer, and later was removed from UFC 212 because his opponents just fell through and nothing was doing. So he had kind of almost had the summer off. We had this very, very interesting UFC summer kickoff press conference. I almost said marred, but really highlighted by the Michael Chiesa, Kevin Lee scrap out of nowhere. You have all these big stars on the dais there, and out of nowhere, these two guys headlining a show in Oklahoma City decide to throw punches and really just kind of take the headlines for the day. Daniel Cormier, John Jones are both on the dais as well, and then there was a scrap backstage. This was a lot of fun. So this was obviously setting the tone for a while, the second half of the year. We would later learn, of course, in the month that John Jones versus Daniel Cormier 2 would officially headline 212. So much for Dana White's proclamation that John Jones would never headline a show again. Chris Weidman versus Kelvin Gastelum was set to headline UFC on Fox 25. We got the announcement that the UFC was going to bring the Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series to Fight Pass. We learned that UFC was going to be returning to both Mexico and Japan later in the year. That secret business that Anthony Johnson said he was going to retire for, it was a marijuana business. But he did say he was getting the itch to return to the cage. Big surprise there. Luke Rockhold to Dana White, quote unquote, think before you run your mouth. Dana White back to Luke Rockhold, stick to modeling and fighting. So public fights are always fun between fighters and heads of state. They, Demetrius Johnson, starting to get a little bit more outspoken and setting the tone for what we'd hear a little bit more of in June, talking about the Ronda Rousey loss and basically telling her to get over it and kind of how to carry yourself after defeats. That got a lot of headlines around. Cody Garbrandt is out of the was out of his July fight against TJ Dillashaw due to a back injury, led to a lot of rumors about Demetrius Johnson versus TJ Dillashaw next up. However, Demetrius Johnson said he wanted Ray Borg, and this would obviously lead to some bigger things we'll talk about in a few minutes. You guys remember the UFC Fighter Summit? That was all kinds of headlines coming out of that. Cyborg Santos, or Cyborg Justino, rather, punching Angela Magana outside the Fighter Summit. Cajun Johnson, a UFC lightweight, not a lot of people know about, speaking out against the Reebok deal, actually in the whole event itself, while the Reebok reps are on stage. That wasn't really received that well. Kobe Bryant was there. A Budweiser rep was talking to the fighters and was drunk on stage. Snoop Dogg was there, and Al Iaquinto was not impressed by that. Made it well known. Speaking of not being impressed, Gegard Mousasi was not impressed with the UFC's initial offer to him to return. Roy Nelson signed with Bellator. Courtney Casey was suspended by Texas for drug test issues that wouldn't be failures by USADA, so that was a big head-scratcher. We had Amanda Nunes versus Valentina Shevchenko, the rematch set for July's UFC 213 event. UFC Rotterdam got Stefan Struve versus Volkov as the main event. And finally, Ronda Rousey booked as team captain in Battle of the Network Stars reboot. Sean Wheelock, any of those amazing grouping of news items stand out to you from the big month of May?
Yeah, a lot jumped out. I'll start with Battle of the Network Stars. That's a show I loved as a kid, and I wouldn't have watched the reboot, and my 12-year-old Ellie is in love with that show. She's not a huge Ronda Rousey fan. She does Muay Thai at the American Top Team School in Kansas City, but she just loved that. So I watched every minute of every episode all summer long of Battle of the Network Stars, mostly on DVR because I've been traveling so much, but I would get home and she would want to watch Battle of the Network Stars. Look, good for Ronda Rousey. She's married. She's going to have a different life. I think she's done fighting and that's her next step. And I can only imagine that she was paid a very nice sum of money because that aired on ABC. I would imagine, I'm going to say as a guy who works in the TV business, that was probably a minimum of $50,000 a show and probably a lot more. That's informed speculation. I have no idea, really, but good for her. So when you were talking about the Gustafsson fight, I watched that. I was in St. Petersburg. It was two nights before an M1 I was doing in St. Petersburg, Russia. And that's one of the few times as I'm watching a fight, I'm thinking the corner really needs to stop it. You know, as I've commentated a decent amount of boxing post-Bellator for me, and I love boxing. I love MMA more, but I do love boxing. It's not uncommon. I just had a fight 2 weeks ago on BN Sports in Austin, Texas, and the kid quit on the stool in the main event title fight. It happens in boxing. But you don't see that often in MMA or the corner throws in the towel. And I really thought the humane thing for Teixeira's corner would have been to throw in the towel. You just don't see it in MMA because guys really don't take beatings in MMA. Guys get smashed in MMA, but they don't really take prolonged beatings. The sport just doesn't lend itself to that. Glover Teixeira against Alexander Gustafsson took a prolonged beating in that fight to where I think that his corner probably should have thought about throwing in the towel. Now, a corner does that, they could lose their fight or he could move on to a different camp and completely change everything, starting with his manager, his agent, his corner, his whole team. But that was a beating. And I know Glover Teixeira is a really cool guy. He's a really nice guy. And that was tough to watch. Gustafsson is a great guy as well. But that was just a complete beatdown. And on that same card, you talked about it, was the real coming out for the Swiss fighter, the light heavyweight, I'm sorry.
Volkan Özdemir.
And Volkan Özdemir fought in Bellator, and I don't think many people remember this. And he's such a nice guy. When he came to his first fight, we were in Ohio, and he brought Swiss candy bars, chocolate bars for everybody, and he passed them around to the production crew. So lovely guy. And then they put him in against Kelly Anderson. And Kelly Anderson was a very good college wrestler, and Kelly Anderson took him down at will and finished him. And Bellator cut him. And it's just one of those mysterious cuts, not where fighters walk like Hector Lombard or Eddie Alvarez, but when fighters are cut by Bellator, and you're thinking, wow, that really maybe wasn't the best decision at the time, because it was a bad loss and it was a bad stylistic matchup against a wrestler in Kelly Anderson. But Volkan Uzdemir has really emerged as a world-class fighter. When I was doing the podcast with Askren and Warren, and we were talking about it, and they're both like, Volkan who? Like, they had no idea who the guy was. And now 6 months later, it was like kind of that Robert Whittaker type fight. Going into 2017, a lot of people, even pretty close to hardcore level, didn't know who these guys were, and now everybody knows. You know, Ben Askren and Joe Warren definitely know who Volkan Uzdemir is now. That was an amazing performance, and it was a weird ending to that fight, but it was an amazing performance. He's really good and really talented, and I don't know how Bellator works. I've been gone almost 2.5 years, but I'm guessing they probably wish that they still had him under contract.
Yeah.
It wasn't a Scott Coker decision at the time. Bjorn Rebney was still running the company, but those are the types of fighters that can do some very good things, and when you come from a country that really hasn't been big in MMA like Switzerland, you have a chance to get a lot of new fans just based on one fighter, without question on that. Also, as you talked about the build-up to Mayweather-McGregor, and I remember thinking at the time Dana White was just posturing, because the way it works, and I'm sure you know this, Josh, if you're a promoter, you talk to a venue and you book a date, and then you put down a security deposit, refundable or non-refundable. So when Dana White portrayed to the press, like, oh, this date has been snatched away with the Triple G Canelo Alvarez fight, it just felt really disingenuous. It felt to me like he was getting close, but he didn't have his contract set. And as we saw the fight, you know, the UFC, Dana White, were really minimalized in that. It was really a Floyd Money Mayweather show that happened to feature the biggest star in the UFC. But it wasn't the UFC co-promote or even the UFC show that everybody thought. Now, I think in theory and on paper and according to the Nevada licenses, it was a UFC co-promote, but it really wasn't a UFC co-promote. You didn't think that was a UFC show. That was a Mayweather show. That was a Showtime boxing show on Showtime pay-per-view that just happened to feature, again, the biggest star in the UFC and in MMA and Conor McGregor. But, yeah, as you're reading and I'm thinking about all of those fights and all that news, that was just a phenomenal summer for MMA. You know, so many people, Josh, want to say, oh, MMA is down. And I talked earlier as we were doing this interview about maybe the lack of big stars in the sport or emerging stars, but you know, MMA is still in a really healthy place. The sport turned 24 years old. November 12, 1993 is the anniversary of UFC 1, which for me, that's when our sport started. I mean, 24 years, can you imagine? The NFL started in 1920. So they were 24 years old in 1994, man. You know, this is still a very, very new sport, and I think it's really healthy. And just the list that you were giving shows how healthy this sport is. Is it as healthy as it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago? Yes, in some ways, and probably no in other ways, but this sport continues to move forward, continues to progress.
Well, if you thought that was big, wait till you hear the June. I think for the first half of the year, for first half, this was the most newsworthy month, and you just talked about, so a perfect segue. It's like you've done this before. We finally got, quote unquote, the fight. After months and months and months of posturing and will they, won't they, no way, yes way, blah, blah, blah. Started out with Floyd Mayweather reserving the MGM Grand for August 26th. Then all of a sudden, that got retracted. Nevada Athletic Commission, however, approved the day for his company, Mayweather Promotions, to run a show. We had no idea what type of show. All this speculation, you know, maybe it's not going to happen. It's just going to be, you know, a smaller event or something like that. Then finally, around the middle of the month, it was, I can't remember who broke the story first, but it was official that we got a fight. 154 pounds, 12 rounds, August 26th. June 14th was a very, very big day in the year. And that just raised all types of questions. We're finally going to get Floyd Mayweather, Conor McGregor in a boxing fight. And all types of questions. A few of them I have here from what was talked about. Will Conor ever come back to UFC or mixed martial arts in general after this? Is the card going to be a mixed card? Is there going to be MMA fights and boxing fights? There were predictions galore. Who's going to be on the broadcast team? There was a lot of talk about, you know, is Joe Rogan going to be involved and so on. Ice Cube actually was a player in this because he held the date for the T-Mobile Arena for the finale of the 3-on-3 basketball league that he owns. So that was a question of how they were going to get around that, because they wanted to run the T-Mobile as the and they eventually would get that as the venue. Also, the effect on Canelo Alvarez versus Triple G happening a week after. There's a lot of talk about that. There were so many questions, predictions galore, and then we kind of, you know, started to learn. This is really, as you were kind of alluding to, this is Showtime's ballgame. This is their arena, literally. This is their ring. And this was, you know, there was no, they were going to have some sort of, you know, presence in terms of, not necessarily broadcast, but kind of some of the talking heads and so on leading up to it. As we learned, Brandon Shaw be involved. Errol Helwani was supposed to be involved, and he got removed due to, you know, Dana White not wanting him to be involved. But obviously no Joe Rogan, there was never a plan to do a, you know, mixed martial arts type day or any type of MMA fights on the card. We thought maybe there might be, you know, maybe a UFC event earlier in the day and so on. But those doors are pretty much closed quickly to the MMA crowd, and those people kind of came along for the ride. And this was, we learned this is going to be a boxing show, and this is going to be your typical boxing show where it is your centerpiece is this mega fight. But regardless, we finally got the fight after months and months of talking. And what was your when you first heard that this fight was a go? Do you remember kind of where you were and what you thought?
Yeah, I was surprised that it wasn't more of a hybrid. I think a lot of people, especially students of the history of major promotions, thought this was going to be a lot like what happened when Muhammad Ali fought Antonio Inoki in Japan, mm-hmm. and Vince McMahon Sr. did the sister event at Shea Stadium when they had on the card Chuck Wepner versus Andre the Giant. And that it was going to be kind of a hybrid thing. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And that it was going to be a hybrid. But this was a straight boxing card. And it was very much, and I'll reiterate what I was saying a moment ago, it was very much a UFC star, an MMA star, going into boxing. This didn't feel like a co-promote. It didn't feel like a hybrid event. This was a straight boxing card. This was a Showtime pay-per-view. This was a boxing show. It was a Floyd Mayweather Jr. promotion. It just happened to feature the biggest star in MMA, Conor McGregor. The fight was fun. I really enjoyed it. The fight was fun. Anybody who thought that Conor McGregor was going to win, I think, was delusional. And they didn't understand boxing. Just like if it had been reversed, if this was MMA, it's a 20-second squash. And I think people who also thought, oh, that Mayweather is going to dust McGregor in a round, have no idea who Floyd Mayweather Jr. is, apart from they know his name. They don't know that he's the greatest defensive fighter of his generation and maybe ever. But this isn't Mike Tyson in the mid to late 1980s knocking people out. It's almost like if you think that someone is going to hit 40 home runs and then you get Ichiro Suzuki, you just know that he hits a ball, that you don't really understand what they do. That, by the way, is my lone baseball reference because I'm not really a baseball fan. I'm just
well
trying
done.
To think of a single hitter. Thank you very much. But it was a fun fight, and I was invited to a fight party, the guy who owns the gym where I train, and you know, there were a mix of people there. There were fighters or professional fighters from my gym, MMA guys who were there. There were boxing people. There were people who I don't think had probably watched a pay-per-view with boxing since Evander Holyfield in the 1990s. But it really drew people in. And I know the pay-per-view projections were higher, but it's still the second most viewed pay-per-view of all time. And I think supporters would say, you know, if it wasn't for all the piracy, it would be number one. But regardless, number one, number two, number one still stands as Mayweather-Pacquiao. It's still a phenomenal accomplishment. It definitely helped boxing. There's no question in my mind it helped boxing. What does it do for Conor McGregor? Floyd Mayweather Jr. is done now, 50-0. He came out of quote-unquote retirement for that fight. I don't see him coming back, and I don't know why anybody would want to see a rematch between those two. I have no idea what there would be to prove. The fight went the way I think people who understand both sports, certainly you know this, Josh, because I'm sure it went the way that you thought that it would go. So why would you see a rematch? You know, there's talk about that he will fight, that McGregor would fight Pauly Malignaggi or that he's going to fight Manny Pacquiao. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I don't know. That whole thing might be played. But what does this do with Conor McGregor now? what happens if he fights Khabib Nurmagomedov and gets smashed? I mean, does he have the will? Does he have the desire to fight again in MMA with that type of money? It's a game changer for Conor McGregor. It's not a game changer for boxing or MMA or the UFC or Floyd Mayweather Jr. It's a game changer for Conor McGregor because of all that money and all that fame. But as the event went, it really went as well as I think anybody most wildly optimistic could have thought that it could have gone, unless you were just a hardcore McGregor fan who somehow thought he would win, or you didn't like him and you loved Mayweather and you thought he would win in a round or two rounds. But as an event, from a strictly neutral perspective, I thought it was a great night. I think boxing was more of the beneficiary than MMA, but it was a great night. One thing as a side note it exposed is how little the vast, 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 vast majority of sports media knows about our sport of mixed martial arts.
Oh, yeah.
Just ridiculously inane, stupid comments from very, very smart people, including boxing people. You know, Art Davey always calls this the MMA bubble. He always says to me, Sean, you know, we live in the MMA bubble. And that is so true. Josh, you live in it. I'm going to say basically 100% of the people who listen to your show live in the MMA bubble. If they didn't, they probably wouldn't be listening to this show and know who we are. But for people outside of that, this is still kind of a novelty act. This is still kind of a sideshow that they don't really pay attention to or understand. And the comments, again, by some really smart journalists and things that were written and commentators, I mean, just pathetic. It was to the point of being embarrassingly bad.
Mm, I agree. One other final note on this is, this really marked an interesting point for UFC in this new ownership group, in that they were willing to essentially lease out one of their stars to a land in which he was not that familiar. And granted, you know, they were kind of holding his hand along the way. Dana White was on that promotional tour and obviously heavily involved and so on. But essentially they were saying, look, and you mentioned the lack of co-promotion. I remember on that first call that they did, I was sitting downstairs in my living room listening and recording. And both fighters were not on it, but it was all the ancillaries and so on. And there was no, they introduced, when they were kind of doing the intro, they mentioned, Irish superstar Conor McGregor, never saying UFC lightweight champion.
Right.
And
oh, yeah.
They really stayed away for what, and I can't figure out why, but they just stayed away from that UFC name. And you didn't see UFC again on any of the, other than some footage, you didn't see them, any of the backdrops, any of that type of stuff. There was no, like, this was Showtime show, and essentially UFC is like, look, our biggest star is going to make a ton of money for this. But they're like, you know, yeah, he seems to think he's know what he's doing, so you can have him, and, you know, you return him back as in best a condition as you can. We'll see if we can use him again, and we'll take the checks.
Yep.
Thank you very much. And that was, who knows where this kind of goes in the future, and you know, obviously there's Mayweather Pacquiao talk and just all this crazy stuff just for kind of headlines and everything. But, you know, I guess we'll see. But this was super interesting in so many different ways. And I think a great book could be written about this someday of just, they were willing for the first time to be like, okay, you can rent our guy.
Yeah. And it's a new era, and it really is a new era with UFC. This is the fourth ownership group. Ownership group number one was Art Davey and Horion Gracie. Ownership number two was Bob Myrowitz, which was Semaphore Entertainment Group, but it was all Myrowitz. Number three was the Fertittas with Dana White. And now number four is WMEIMG. Dana White's still there, but not in the role. He still has ownership equity, but not in the same role. This is a new era, this fourth ownership era for the UFC. There's no question about it. So as I was talking about, I've commentated a lot more boxing post-Bellator for me. I've done two boxing shows, I think, in the last 4 weeks now. And I love boxing. I love MMA more. I'll tell everybody that. But I do love boxing. And that was my first combat sport as a kid. It was the first thing I tried as a combat sport. It was the first combat sport that I watched, along with pro wrestling, of course, because, you know, I'm a huge mark. I'm a huge kayfabe guy.
That's right.
But I was in love with boxing. I mean, I remember watching fights at 6 and 7 years old. That's how much of a boxing fan I was. But now living fully in both worlds as a commentator, I can tell you that MMA people, by and large, and I'm making a generalization, but bear with me, MMA people, by and large, really follow boxing. Boxing people, by and large, really don't follow MMA. And if you don't buy into my theory, I would say take a really hard look at everything that you and I are talking about that surrounded Mayweather-McGregor. That was a show done by boxing people for boxing people. And I think it played out. Had the UFC controlled it, you would have seen a hybrid card and you would have seen different elements and different things. But that was really a classically promoted, produced, televised, displayed, advertised boxing show. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but it just shows the contrast in the two worlds. I mean, I have boxing people that still can't get the name MMA right. It's amazing to me. And I'm not making that up. They won't say MMA. They'll say, like, you do that MMM stuff or the MAA stuff. I hear MAA a lot, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
But I don't have any of my MMA friends say, do you do that box? What is that box?
Bixing?
Something? They're like, yeah, they'll say, oh, Sean, I actually saw you do that fight. That was really cool, you know?
Right.
It's interesting. And maybe it's because boxing goes back to the 18th century with the London Prize Ring rules and the Broughton rules, and MMA goes back to November 12, 1993. That's probably a lot of it. But, yeah, if there's a postscript on Mayweather-McGregor, it wasn't a co-promote, really. It wasn't a hybrid show at all. It was a boxing show. That's absolutely what it was. I loved it. It was great, but it was a boxing show.
So back to an MMA show. Big show, relatively, that month. Big in terms of it was not big in terms of pay-per-view buys or, but it was attention grabbing. It was kind of an interesting weekend. Bellator, your old employers going back to, or going to New York City, Madison Square Garden, where obviously UFC had run, just about 8 months prior, headlining, they returned to pay-per-view. They did a show like Bellator 180, which was kind of, you know, the Spike prelim, so to speak, but it's also kind of a main card in its own right. And then the transition to pay-per-view with, you know, two different announced teams and so on. But, headlined, Chael Sonnen downing, Wanderlei Silva, kind of ending their long, long, public feud. Supposed to happen in the UFC, finally happened in Bellator, and Chael Sonnen, being, Wanderlei Silva, kind of a meh fight, kind of boring. We had Matt Mitrione knocking out Fedor Emelianenko, that was highlighted by this amazing double dock down, which you'd like probably see in a movie. You know, it's kind of like the Rocky and Apollo
right.
Creed type thing. Douglas Lima outlasting Lorenz Larkin to retain his welterweight title in the fight. I think disappointed a lot of people. They were expecting a little bit more, and the fight was just, it just really wasn't there for whatever reason. It just didn't work. Michael Chandler, really shocking loss to Brett Primus, due to what I called an elastic ankle. If you remember just the visual of Michael Chandler gamely trying to stand of this foot that would just not allow him to stand up in that fight. Obviously, Primus getting the lightweight title. Very shocking result there. And on the undercard, you know, Ryan Bader winning light heavyweight title. And also to open up the pay-per-view, pretty shocking defeat in a lot of ways. Aaron Pico making his long way of debut, ending badly, 24 seconds going down in defeat. And obviously he's on the comeback trail from that. But, you know, there's so much here with this and that, you know, Bellator was trying to mix this kind of the old and the new and, doing like a really long event. Again, the two broadcast teams return to pay-per-view. Yeah, I would say in some ways it was a success because they got the eyes of the fight world on them for essentially a night. And, I don't know really if they did, you know, it wasn't like, you know, business went great guns after the show, but it was a show and it was something to watch and it was a spectacle. And I guess they're going to go back at some point to Madison Square Garden, but you know, it was a mixed bag in terms of results. Again, Michael Chandler going down, the Larkin fight didn't really go that great. There were some highlights, but it was kind of, I think results-wise, it was kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, because I was a Bellator for 5.5 years at 129 straight shows, and obviously it didn't end great for me. But as I've said time and time again, all of the ill will and animosity I have, and I'm not an angry person. I mean, it is what it is. People get fired, whatever. But it was all towards Spike. It was never towards Bellator. And I have a lot of friends who still fight for Bellator. And I have friends who have since gone to Bellator since I left. You know, I've watched every single Bellator since I was fired by Spike 2.5 years. But, you know, I've watched every World Series of Fighting. And then I had a chance to commentate for the new World Series of Fighting, PFL, in November. But I always watch WSOF. I watch every UFC. I'm a hardcore. I watch everything. So I just give that caveat. If I say anything that sounds remotely critical, I understand there are people who say sour grapes. It's not, but whatever. If people want to perceive that, that's fine. The reality is Bellator on that night was the center of the MMA universe. But as you said, the card did not certainly go as they planned. I just read something that post-Bellator, with the events they did, and I think it's 11, it might be 12, but their average television audience live on Spike is 488,000, which is a tremendous dip. You know, you're talking down, I'm guessing, 150, 180,000 from where they've been year to date. There was no post pay-per-view bounce or buzz. They had all the attention, and it's dropped off. And there are obviously a lot of factors. Is it certainly key injuries, and they're trying to develop some foreign markets and being on tape delay, especially in this era when everything is there instantaneously with results, doesn't help. But if you're sub 500,000 after a pay-per-view, that's tough. I've heard from a number of TV executives, not MMA people, but TV people, that the pay-per-view numbers were around 55,000 to 58,000. I don't know. I can tell you I had dinner a week after with a major television executive, and he said, I heard the Bellator pay-per-view did 58,000. I'm like, dude, no chance. I'll bet it, if it bombed, it did 110. You know, it came out, I think Dave Meltzer reported maybe 100,000. I don't know. You know, getting a pay-per-view, accurate pay-per-view count is virtually impossible. It doesn't have to be released. I think maybe in public SEC filings, but it's not like Nielsen ratings where they are there. Right. And there's a way to turn numbers. But it certainly didn't hit the 250,000. No one's disputing that Scott Coker was predicting. And there hasn't been that buzz afterwards. You know, again, I have a lot of friends who still fight at Bellator, and I want MMA to be healthy, and I want there to be jobs, and I want people to make money. But the second half of Bellator, which maybe was defined by that show, was definitely different from where it seemed like the company had been going under Scott Coker. And again, that's not a criticism, and that's certainly not sour grapes. That's just an observation. I thought the New York show was fun. I enjoyed it. I mean, the Aaron Pico fight was a disaster. And I thought, you know, they should have put him in against a 1-1 kid. What are you doing? You know, you can't let a fighter dictate. Ben Askren said to me, well, I'm sure Pico wanted that fight because he thought he could beat him. And I said, I'm sure he did. That's why you don't let fighters be their own promoters. That's why exactly. You have to look out for people. Fighters think they can beat everybody, and everybody is terrible. I tease my fighter friends all the time. They think everyone is horrible. That's just part of the mentality of it. But the Pico thing certainly didn't go well. The Sonnen fight was disappointing. And I don't know. It seems like if you look at any organization, they're up, they're down. People love the UFC, and then they don't. And then Strikeforce is great, and they turn on it, and there's Bellator, and it was great, and it's not great. I don't know. It seems like there's always this up and down. Bellator has some really interesting, intriguing cards coming up. A lot of people are talking about this heavyweight tournament, which to me, now that we've put in 225 pounds of the cruiserweights with the ABC, maybe it should be a cruiserweight tournament. But this heavyweight tournament, it's going to get a lot of attention, whether people like fighters or think it's valid or not. But yeah, that New York pay-per-view, it just wasn't there, and it's weird. Bellator's done pay-per-views. Bjorn Rebney was fired months after the first pay-per-view that we did when I was still there in 2014, and I'm not saying anyone's getting fired after this one, but it certainly didn't give Bellator a second half of 2017 bounce that clearly they were looking for. And whether the numbers were the 58, 55,000 I heard or 100,000 that Meltzer reported, again, it wasn't the projections they were talking about. And if you're a Viacom-owned property, you're not doing a pay-per-view to get 100,000. You're doing a pay-per-view to get 200,000 or 300,000 and then build your audience from there. Because Bellator, as long as they're owned by Viacom, and I know Spike is becoming the Paramount Network in January, but they're going to use pay-per-view to build the television ratings. It's a totally different model than the UFC, which gains a large portion of their revenue on pay-per-view. It's just a different thing. But a lot of smart people have said to me in the fight game and in the TV industry, it's very difficult to charge people for something they're used to getting for free. Mm-hmm. And that's really the case with pay-per-view.
I would agree wholeheartedly. So our third biggest story of the month, DJ grows up. Demetrius Johnson, the flyweight champion, the guy that was, you know, always just maligned for not being able to draw on pay-per-view and, you know, headlining Fox shows and no one cares about his fights and blah, 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 blah. Everyone trying to figure out what the deal was. So this, I kind of mentioned it when we were talking about May and just some comments that he was making about Ronda Rousey and so on. It was, talking about this proposed DJ versus TJ fight, and Demetrius Johnson did not like it. You know, he wanted TJ, he said he questioned whether he could make the weight, questioned why he was going to be potentially doing a historic title defense against someone that had never fought at flyweight before. A lot of controversy about that. Dana White, of course, firing back, saying it was insane that that fight was going to happen and kind of really putting on Demetrius Johnson. on his shoulders, and of course the public, you know, kind of turning against DJ in some aspects. And then things changed. Demetrius Johnson goes on the MMA Hour with Errol Helwani and does one of the, I'd say one of the best interviews I've heard all year. I'd say top three for sure. And it's in his honesty, in its, you know, every story is two sides, but just where he came from, speaking from the heart. He talked about how, you know, Dana threatened to end the flyweight division. He talked about pay-per-view points and contracts and, you know, just basically what he was fighting for, and just like basically his rationale behind everything. And after that, you know, and he would talk a lot more in the month, and I'd do some follow-ups, but I thought it was a fascinating case study into a guy that once you really kind of let them out and they kind of finally have had enough, and this tidal wave of, you know, the way that things used to be when fighters would do anything for Dana White in the UFC when Lorenzo Fertitta was there, interestingly enough, now that the sale has happened, everything seems to have changed in a lot of ways. And your flyweight champion, your company guy, the guy that fought consistently three times a year defending his title, which champions don't do now, would finally just, he had enough, and he came out, and I came out of that interview that he did and out of this whole situation being like, I had a different appreciation for him because he stood up for himself and he did it publicly, and he did so in a way that was, it was eloquent and it made sense, and it's like, you know what, he's probably right. So Demetrius Johnson had a big June, and he didn't even fight.
Yeah, good for him. And I'm a guy, I'm going to root for the fighters first. That's just how I'm built and how I'm wired. I'm going to root for the fighters. But to me, everything he said made sense. And he's not a prima donna. He's under Matt Hume. I've known Matt since I was in Pride, and Matt's a legend and one of the finest people I've ever met, not just in MMA, but in life. And Matt Hume surrounds himself with great people. And if you're a Matt Hume guy like Demetrius Johnson, then you're a great guy as far as I'm concerned. Everything he said to me made sense. And, you know, earlier in our interview in the segment, we were talking about George St. Pierre. You know, how is WMEIMG going to deal with their biggest stars? Because Demetrius Johnson's one of their biggest stars. He certainly has not broken through the way somebody like Ronda Rousey or Conor McGregor's broken through. But real fight fans know that he's phenomenal. And if he's not number one in your pound-for-pound rankings, he's probably number two. And if he's not number two, then maybe you really have never watched him fight. The guy is spectacular. And I know boxing is the same way. If you get below a certain weight, a lot of people say, yeah, you're really not that good. That's just ridiculous. That's just absolute nonsense to me. The guy is phenomenal. He's done everything the UFC has asked of him, and he just simply had enough. And he's a bright guy, and he's articulate, and it was well-reasoned and well-presented. And you're right. You know, you said it, Josh. People were initially maybe against him on the public opinion poll, and then they swung for him after that Errol Helwani interview. And good for Demetrius Johnson. Yeah, he doesn't draw the huge numbers that maybe Tyron Woodley is going to draw, or Michael Bisping is going to draw at 185, if Bisping was even drawing those numbers. But the guy's phenomenal, and he's a champion, and he's done everything that the UFC has asked of him up until that point. So good for Demetrius Johnson is how I saw that and how I still see that 6 months later.
I would agree. Kind of filled in some of the blanks and really, I don't, again, I don't know if it really propelled him to any type of new heights pay-per-view-wise or drawing-wise or anything like that. But I think kind of just rounded out something that a lot of us want to see. We all knew he was a video games and all this stuff and cheerful guy, but it just kind of add this other, I would say an edge, but it filled in a lot of blanks for me, and I'm glad he did it, you know, and now we kind of understand where he's coming from, and you know, it gave me a different appreciation for him. So I'm glad he did that. And, you know, we'll see. Obviously, Dana White's tune would change on him, of course, later in the year. So he pulled up that amazing submission on Ray Borg. And, you know, we'll see what happens down the road. But let's get into the rest of the month, because there's a lot here. And I'm sure there's a few things here on this list that you're going to want to comment on. A lot of kind of ups and downs, closure to a lot of bad situations and so on. So we'll get into it. Rashad Evans versus Sam Alvey, slated for Mexico City. I note that because it just shows you what stage Rashad Evans was at in his career, where he's booked against Smiling Sam in Mexico City, just trying to trying to get back and reclaim his career and so on. Korean Zombie, Chan Sung Young, obviously had come back earlier in the year. Big victory over Dennis Bermudez, and unfortunately tearing both his ACL and his MCL. He was out of his UFC 214 against Ricardo Lamas and out for a long time, unfortunately, just as he had come back after a long layoff. Dana White said that GSP would fight for the welterweight title upon his return, so that was a change and something that would not happen. We had UFC 212 and Max Holloway taking his ascent to the featherweight, the top of the featherweight mountain, unifying the featherweight titles by TKOing Jose Aldo in the third round to unite the belts. Also on that card, Vitor Belfort edging out Nate Marquardt and deciding not to retire after all. Rafael Sunsau edged out Marlon Moraes in his debut fight for the promotion. And Claudia Gadelha submitting Carolina Kavalkiewicz in the first round and then on to a rematch with her rival, Yuadi Janjacek. Sakuraba was announced he was going to be elected to the UFC Hall of Fame later in the year. Chuck Liddell, we talked about him earlier, decided to post a stare-down pic with Tito Ortiz on Instagram. And then Scott Coker, during the press tour for the Bellator event, said he might do the trilogy fight between those two. We still are waiting to see if that's ever going to happen, and hopefully in a lot of ways it doesn't. Two out-of-court or court cases that put away a couple scumbags. War Machine, John Copenhaver, sentenced to 36 years to life for his savage attack on Christy Mack. I think everyone can agree there is no shortage of bad things that could happen to him in jail, out of jail, just terrible person and terrible situation. And finally found at least some closure in the public sense. Josh Grispy, if you guys remember him, a WEC guy, UFC fighter, almost got a featherweight title shot at one point, found guilty of domestic violence, was attacked his wife using his dog, just a horrendous story, a Massachusetts guy, just very bad stuff there. Dana White, a random headline, wasn't really announced. It was kind of a news item out in Las Vegas that he was buying up Las Vegas mansions in his neighborhood and then bulldozing them down to kind of expand his footprint of his neighborhood out for him a lot more. So, you know, that's how the other half lives, I guess, or the upper 1%, as it were. UFC Auckland, we headed down under. Mark Hunt outlasting Derek Lewis in four rounds and taking him out in four rounds, rather. Derek Lewis kind of announcing his retirement in his post-fight interview and then later would walk it back the rest of the month or later in the month. So Derek Lewis wasn't going anywhere. And then we also had Derek Brunson showing this really kind of underrated in a lot of ways, knocking out Dan Kelly in 76 seconds. Dan Kelly, I don't want to say the closest thing to a Randy Couture, but kind of one of these guys. He's these older guys that just get in there and you're kind of amazed at what they're doing at closing in on 40 years old. And this was a big fight against Derek Brunson, just got dispatched in 76 seconds. Sean Grandy, the guy that replaced you at Bellator, was out at Bellator. And then Mauro Ranallo and Mike Goldberg were in Bellator. So the announcing carousel at this promotion continues. Sad story, Matt Hughes' truck got hit by a train. This was one of these stories that came out of nowhere. He was airlifted to a medical facility, did not look good for a while. And thankfully now seems to be on the road to recovery and so on. And just one of those stories you hear, just amazing. Matt Hughes' truck just getting hit by a train out of all things. We headed to Singapore for a UFC event on Fight Pass. Holly Holm knocking out Betchka Hea, really returning to form there. This was a great finish, especially for those people that love pro wrestling. Kohea was taunting her, kind of saying, come on, let's go, let's go. Holm rips off this question mark kick and just flattens Correa. It was just a really just fun finish to a otherwise kind of blah fight. UFC 214, it was announced we were going to get Cyborg Justino against Megan Anderson for the vacant featherweight title because Jermaine Duranemi was stripped of the title because she didn't want to fight Cyborg. And a few weeks later, Anderson was out, and then Tanya Evinger got called up from Invicta to take the spot against Cyborg at UFC 214. Sad story out in Edmonton that actually was just newsworthy in the past week because Edmonton has decided to suspend all combat sports for the next year. Tim Hague dying after a bad knockout loss in boxing, just 34 years old, kids, all that. Just a really sad story. Really hit a lot of people in the community pretty hard and a lot of questions about why he was allowed to fight. The fighter that beat him was noticing that, you know, Hague was pretty well hurt and the referee didn't call it off. Just a lot of issues there. UFC Oklahoma City, talking about that press conference earlier. Kevin Lee, controversial submission over Michael Chiesa in the main event. Dennis Seaver defeating BJ Penn, rather. By a split decision or unanimous decision, I believe. What was notable about this was really just buried on the Fox Sports 1 portion of the show. I think it might have been a six-fight card, or maybe it was just one of these things where all of a sudden it's like, oh, by the way, BJ Penn is fighting. It was just crazy in 2017 that he was just kind of just like, kind of just pushed out to pasture, almost like, all right, we don't really want people to look at what's going to happen. And Devin Seaver taking BJ Penn out, and probably will never see him fight in the UFC ever again. Tim Bosch beating up Johnny Hendricks on that show. And then Justine Kish pooped herself on national TV, taking on Felice Herrig. UFC canceled their pay-per-view for August 19th. No big surprise. There was no venue announced or really anything going on there, but they were clearing the decks for Mayweather-McGregor to get all that money. Bellator 183 got a main event of Benson Henderson versus Patricky Pitbull. Donald Cerrone got a blood infection that pulled him out of his UFC 213 tilt with Robbie Lawler. We learned that we would get Woodley versus Maya, a title fight, the welterweight title fight at UFC 214. And Dana White said GSP was going to get the winner of that. That would obviously change. UFC 215 got Ngannou versus JDS. Lorenzo Fertitta actually answered some deposition questions as part of this long, long, long legal procedure for this antitrust lawsuit against UFC. Michelle Waterson, the karate hottie, was announced as one of the cover girls, or cover people, rather, for the ESPN body issues. Nick Diaz, remember him? He was flagged by USADA for missing a lot of tests. That was fun to follow. Snoop Dogg and Uriah Faber has announced they were going to do the Snoopcast commentary for Tuesday Night Fights. No doubt a big inspiration for your commentary, Sean. And then finally, John Fitch submitting Brian Foster at PFL 1, his first submission in 10 years. A lot there to unpack. A lot of, again, kind of sad stories with Tim Hague. You have these guys getting put in jail. A lot of interesting results. Max Holloway, all kinds of stuff. What's it out about the rest of the month for June for you?
Yeah, you want me to talk about Sean Grande, and that's cool.
Yeah, we can go there too. Yeah.
I will say that I landed in Russia. It was one of my 12 Russia trips this year, and I turned on my phone, and I was at baggage claim, and wow, my phone started making a lot of noise. I thought, oh, something happened, something very interesting happened, and then I saw the news. So, look, Sean Grande got fired. Whatever, it happens to us. You know, Mauro Ranallo is spectacular. Mike Goldberg is spectacular. It's the fight business. I never met Sean Grande. I have no ill will. I never had ill will towards him. They certainly weren't going to replace me with an empty chair, and that's fair enough. It's the fight game, and never met the man, and I have nothing bad to say about him at all. What I will say in the big picture, it is extremely difficult to come to any sport as a commentator if you've not been a fan of that sport. It's just really, really difficult. Yeah. And all of us know in MMA that we have a large percentage of hardcores. And I think about this all the time. I'm a huge NFL fan. I'm a crazy NFL fan. I've never been an NFL commentator. I'm an NFL fan. When I'm watching an NFL game and 18 million people are watching Sunday Night Football, what percentage of those people are really serious hardcores? I mean, you know, real hardcore people. 10% of the audience, maybe? Yeah. 15, 20?
Yeah.
Is that fair, Josh?
Yeah, I'd say.
When you're watching.
Yeah, I would say it depends on, I think people's definition of hardcore is probably changed. But yeah, I would say as far as the people that could understand plays, have played before, all that stuff, yeah, I'd probably say 10, 15%, maybe 20 on good days.
So now the audience numbers are lower, but for instance, when you and I on December 30th, when we'll be watching UFC on pay-per-view from Las Vegas on the December 30th show, what percentage of the people who are watching that pay-per-view are hardcores? I'd say minimum 50%, 50%.
I'd say more than that, yeah.
Yeah, I would honestly say more than that, too. I would say it's probably closer to 70%, to be quite honest. You know, they're always the casuals. But I think it's higher. And then when you're talking about watching Bellator, I think now you're getting into the 80% range of the hardcores, unless it's like the Kimbo Slice Dada fight, I think, or the Shamrock Kimbo fight that I did. I think the average Bellator, you're getting a lot of hardcores. When you're watching PFL or M1 or ONE Championship, you're really in the hardcore territory. And that lends itself to fans being more vocal and being more protective about what are you doing to our sport. And, again, I'm not picking on Sean Grande. I think he was put in a very impossible situation. But if you've never been a fan of a sport, it's a tough learning curve. And I'm not picking on Gus Johnson. Gus Johnson obviously had a difficult time in MMA. And he also had a difficult time in the sport that I used to commentate for a long time, which is soccer, when Fox said, you're going to be our number one guy. And Gus Johnson basically said, I've never really watched soccer. I'm not a fan of this sport.
Yeah.
It's just extremely difficult. Whatever people think of me or don't think of me as a commentator, you're going to hear me on combat sports. Even if you're my biggest fan in the world, if you heard me on golf, Well, I've never played golf or NASCAR. I have no idea what happens in NASCAR. I literally have no concept other than people drive a car. I would be horrible. And I recognize that, and that's why, not that they're asking me, but I would do that. It's a really difficult situation. But look, Mauro Ranallo is awesome. Mike Goldberg's awesome. However people think I was done by Spike, it was 1,000 times worse what the UFC did to Mike Goldberg. I was at Bellator for 5.5 years. He was the voice of the UFC for 20 years. And at least I got whacked. Like, I turned around and I got whacked by Spike. He had to be dead man walking Goldberg for 3 months, which I'm sure wasn't fun. So Sean Grande gets fired. Goldberg and Ranallo come in. Yeah, good for them. They're really good guys, and I'm happy for their success at Bellator. The Tim Haig thing, obviously a very serious situation. That happened right before the ABC convention, and some people listening might know. I know you know this, Josh. I'm heavily involved on the regulatory side with the ABC. It's my very lucrative and time-consuming, non-paying gig that I do, but I absolutely love it. And we were talking a lot about the Tim Haig situation, and I think it was unfortunately misreported, not by the MMA media, but the general sports media, that it was an MMA fight, and it was boxing. Tim Haig, obviously much better known as an MMA fighter than a boxer. But he was kind of cast in a hometown hero situation, and it's just horrible. I mean, there's nothing good that can come out of that situation, even if people say we're going to learn safety protocols and we're going to change things. The reality is that Tim Haig is dead, and he shouldn't be dead, and it's horrible. And it's where we have to see that this is a boxing, kickboxing, MMA, Muay Thai. If there are strikes allowed to the head, it's an inherently dangerous sport. And we have to put in the biggest safety precautions we can. I'm not blaming the Edmonton Commission. I know those people. They're very, very competent, talented people. It was just a really unfortunate situation. And it brings everything home to all of us, just how serious combat sports are. It's easy to lose sight of that fact. And it's horrible for Tim Haig. He's such a great person. And it's just a really tragic situation. As you talk about, like, the War Machine situation, I mean, how horrible. And, look, I knew John Copenhaver War Machine. I knew Christy Mack. They were boyfriend and girlfriend at Bellator when John was fighting there, and I knew them very well. What I would say on that is the people who took to the Internet and were attacking Christy Mack is one of the most repulsive things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And Christy Mack is, look, I don't really know her. I probably met her 10 times in my life, and she was always with John, and she was always very sweet and kind of shy. She is tiny. I mean, she is tiny, like 5 foot tall, tiny, and maybe 95 pounds tiny. But it doesn't matter. If she's 7 feet tall and 500 pounds, it doesn't matter. It's horrific. But just the blame the victim was beyond reprehensible for people. And again, that's a tragic situation. It's just horrible all the way around. But as you talk about the fights, on obviously a much lighter note, it was a great summer for MMA. It really was a great summer. There were phenomenal fights. You know, you talked about Smiling Sam Alvey, a former Bellator fighter, another Bellator fighter. People don't remember he fought in Bellator and got cut at 185, and he also fought at 170. You talk about Dennis Seaver needed a win. The Matt Hughes situation also, obviously terrible. Matt was serving with us on the MMA Rules and Regs Committee for the ABC and always had so much to offer. We do monthly conference calls, and we were all shocked on that. I had dinner with Monty Cox and a group in September, and Monty was just telling Matt Hughes stories. And it just, oh, it's so sad with Matt Hughes. And you know, everything that I know, I haven't spoken to Matt since the accident, but that he continues to recover, and you know, his family's behind him, and he has the full support, and he continues to make a recovery. But yeah, just such a sad situation.
So to wrap this up, obviously been very generous with your time. We appreciate it as always.
Thank you for having me, Josh. I'll just tell you, thank you for having me, man. It's always my pleasure. I'm always happy to do long interviews with you. You're one of the bright lights in journalism out there in combat sports, man. And I appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you very much. I will ask you, you mentioned earlier UFC 1, and it got me to thinking. So you said you talked to Art pretty regularly, almost every day.
Every day.
Did you both listen to the 30 for 30 podcast on UFC 1 that came out, last month or so?
Oh, yeah. No, Art got an advanced copy, and then he sent me an advanced copy. And guess where I was when I listened? You want to take a guess? I was in Russia. How about that? And he got an advanced link. And I thought it was great. Now, here's irony of irony. So Jimmy Smith's wife is an extremely talented documentarian named Sandra Alvarez. She's a television producer. I think she has a series on Netflix right now. But I haven't spoken to Jimmy in a long time. But Sandra's awesome and extremely talented. So about 4 years ago, I introduced Sandra to Art Davey. He had come to a Bellator to hang out with me. And she pitched the 30 for 30 doc to ESPN. And they passed. And they really liked her. And it was kind of like, yeah, we like you. What else do you have? But they weren't that interested in the birth of the UFC story. And then it turns around and it comes out as a podcast, as an audio doc, as an audio documentary. But I thought that was kind of interesting. I think Sandra would have really blown it apart. She would have done a phenomenal job. Obviously, it's a different medium when you're doing television or film. But it was great. I was so happy on it. You know, it was I'm Art's biggest advocate and biggest defender. The Campbell McLaren stuff bothered me in there. He cheap shot at Art Davey, but then what else would you expect from Campbell McLaren but to rewrite history in his favor and the cheap shot Art Davey? But it was really well done. I've done a few audio docs for the BBC, so I understand how to put those together. Those guys were great. And then it didn't get a lot of attention, but like 2 weeks after the ESPN people called Art, our book publisher from Is This Legal said, hey, I just got a call from the BBC in Manchester, and they want to do something with Art, so we put us in touch. And so I called. I knew the guy because I've done a lot of stuff for the BBC. And then they did a little 10-minute mini-doc on the birth of the UFC that aired, and it's on the BBC website.
Oh, okay.
Also, it wasn't nearly as comprehensive or as detailed as the ESPN 30 for 30 audio doc, but it was equally great. It was just shorter. But so I'm glad to see them picking that up. You know, Art Davey is a person like I've never had in my life before. My girls call him Grandpa Art. He's a phenomenal guy. I speak to him on the phone every day. And I think John McCarthy and myself are bigger Art Davey defenders for his place in the UFC than even Art is. Sometimes I don't think Art is that bothered. Obviously, he'd like to be in the UFC Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
He gets the biggest kick out of it when people know him, but it's not how he lives his life. And that's one of the reasons why I love, and I don't use that word lightly, I love Art so much, is because he's not defined by that. He was 46 years old when the UFC started. He's a Vietnam veteran. He had made his money. He had been married multiple times. In fact, you know, he had had successes. He had had failures in business. He's not defined as that one-hit wonder. He's not that guy who says, you know, wow, I wrote this book 30 years ago that was a bestseller. Well, I haven't done anything since. Or I had that one number one song. Or I starred in that one movie. Or I had this one great season in the NFL. It was a chapter in his life, and it was a significant chapter, and it changed the lives of a lot of people, including myself, but he's not defined by it. All that being said, when he gets recognized by people like ESPN and the BBC, and our book has been optioned, it's being developed right now as a film. I met with the screenwriters last week. All that's really great because I think the story has to be told. You know, our screenwriters, so I'll a quick caveat. So our screenwriters, A-list guys who have been hired to adapt our book, Is This Legal, into this movie. They said, you know, when we've been talking to our friends and we say we're doing a book about the founder of the UFC, 100% of the time they say, oh, Dana White, you know, and that's unfortunate. You know, Dana White came along in 2001. UFC started in 1993, but sometimes the guys at the beginning kind of get forgotten, and I'm hoping, I know the book did this a little bit, but if there is a film, which I have every expectation there will be, I mean, they're writing us checks, and they are developing it right now, that Art really gets his due on that. And then it won't be so shocking if there is a 30 for 30, you would almost expect there to be something like that.
Did you happen to catch the 30 for 30 plus that they do when they do kind of an interview with the creators and so on. Did you happen to hear that as well?
I did. I absolutely did. I certainly did listen to that. And Art loved the guys. It was two guys who actually came out. It was the producer and the guy who hosted came out and spent a lot of time with him in Vegas. And I think I know he did two interviews. I think he said the first one was something like 6 hours and the second one was 4 hours. Jeez. And again, having done audio docs, I know you'll literally, you know, get 30 minutes to get a 2-second soundbite. It's maddening. It's difficult how much you have to cut out.
Yeah.
But Art knew it was going to be good, he said, by the questions they asked him. And that's why I like you as an interviewer, Josh, because you ask really smart questions. You usually can tell how it's going to go by the level of questions. And these guys were digging pretty deep on it. I said, other than Campbell McLaren rewriting history and cheap-shotting Art, I thought it was fantastic. But that's no fault of the ESPN guys. Campbell's going to say what Campbell's going to say.
Yeah, because that's what I wanted to ask about. So during they talked about this. They actually played the clip when I think they brought up Bob Meyerowitz, and he's like, you're talking to Bob? And they're like, yeah. And he just got up and left, and they had to go out to his car. And basically just, I guess the interview ended that day, but they ended up talking again. I was kind of befuddled by that because, why wouldn't they be talking to him? I don't know if it was just grandstanding, it could be, or something else going on there, but I don't know if he had any insight on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know Bob Meyerowitz. I'll tell you another great thing about Art Davie. He is incapable of holding a grudge. He's not mad at anybody. John McCarthy and I are the ones who get angry at Campbell McLaren all the time for all of his lies and rewriting history and cheap-shotting Art. Bob Meyerowitz has pretty much disappeared from it. But Art's not mad at Bob Meyerowitz. He's not mad at Campbell McLaren. He's not mad at anybody. He really isn't. He's like the most magnanimous person I've ever met. But, you know, Art Davie took an idea in his head that he started developing in the fall of 1989 when he was an advertising man as a pitch for Tecate Beer, and 4 years later became UFC One, and he wound up making $1 million on it when he sold it. And then he went to work for Bob Meyerowitz for another 2 years running the company that he sold to Meyerowitz. Meyerowitz, if there's anyone who unfortunately kind of lost in the history of this, is a guy who bought the UFC for $1 million, accumulated debt, stripped off all the assets, wound up selling it for $2 million and the assumption of $2 million in debt, and that became a $4 billion company. You know, Art Davie, a lot of people have said to Art, you sold a $4 billion company, but Art Davie didn't sell a $4 billion company. You know, to think up something and sell it for $1 million 4 years later is a tremendous accomplishment. But I'm by no means calling Bob Meyerowitz a loser. I mean, the man's been very, very successful in the pay-per-view business. He's a pioneer. He believed enough in the UFC to give it a try. He was very successful in music. If anybody remembers the King Biscuit Flower Hour, that was his show where he made a lot of his money. Yeah. But if anyone can look and say, I sold a $4 billion company and didn't get rich, although he was already rich, is Bob Meyerowitz. But, you know, he was put in the UFC Hall of Fame 2 years ago. I was told by the people I know at the UFC that was the Fertittas trying to close the circle. But Campbell McLaren is a guy who always wants to rewrite history. You know, Campbell McLaren played a very important role in shepherding Art Davie's project through. He believed in Art Davie. But honestly, Josh, what Campbell McLaren does would be like me telling people in 20 years that I created Bellator just because I happened to be around Bjorn Rebney when he did.
Yeah.
You know, I was there and you know, I saw a lot of things and I played a small part, but I didn't create it. And it's the same with Campbell McLaren, but whatever. He's got to sell his Combate America, so that's on him. But I think that the fans know. And look, I'll get in a shameless book plug. If anybody wants to know the real story, books on Amazon, you can find in Barnes & Noble. It's called Is This Legal? Again, it's being developed as a motion picture. Hopefully a lot more people will become aware of it when the film comes out. But that's the real story, you know, and we reprinted contracts, faxes. If people remember what a fax machine was, F-A-X-E-X-E-S, faxes, it's all in there. All the real story is in there. So when people say, well, how do you know Campbell McLaren is lying? Because I have the documents. I read the contracts. I read the correspondence. Art Davie saves everything. So it's all in there. But, again, I get worked up. McCarthy gets worked up. Art Davie's not bothered. He just has a scotch and smokes a cigar, and he's happy.
Hmm. All right. Well, I was just going to throw the microphone over to you and ask you to plug away. So we have the book. What else? Where can people hear you next? And again, we kind of mentioned at the top that you're taking a little bit of time off here, but right back into it. Where can people hear with you, interact with you, ask you questions? The floor is yours.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm trying to be better on media. My 12-year-old daughter, Ellie, I think, is my social media manager. She's encouraging me. She opened my Instagram account. But people hit me up on Twitter. I do my best to respond on that. I commentate M1 in Russia. I commentate Victory on UFC Fight Pass. I did my first PFL show, which was just a phenomenal experience. I did that in D.C. for them. We'll see what happens there. I do boxing on CBS Sports and BN Sports. So If I'm not working, there's a good chance I'm going to fight in Kansas. Come say hey to me. But probably the best way is on Twitter, and that's at Sean Wheelock. And I do have to do better on social media, Josh. You do so well on that. And I'll see what happens with the podcast, too. You know, I had so much fun doing the podcast with Ben Askren and Joe Warren, and we thought we were in for the long haul with podcast one, and they told us they liked us, and they canceled us after 18 weeks, but what are you going to do? So yeah. I'll try to bring back a podcast. You have this figured out. I need to talk with you off air about how you're doing this, but podcasting is definitely fun. I do miss it.
Yeah. Good stuff. Great stuff. We'll be certainly hearing a lot from you in 2018, both literally and figuratively, I guess you can say. Yeah, we'll be actually hearing from you. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, good stuff. So, again, big thanks to for you for stopping by this week, and looking forward to speaking next year. Sean Wheelock, thanks for coming back to Josh Jason's Punch-Out.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate it. Thank you, Josh.
All right. Big thanks to Sean Wheelock and Chad Dundas for stopping by. Obviously, you can follow them on social media. Buy their books. Let them know. You get plenty of time, again, over this holiday season. Take some time and maybe get a little bit of reading in, audiobooks, all that type of stuff. So I assume both are in audio form. If not, check them out. Or just read them if you haven't already and let them know that you heard about them here. Let's see. I think that's about it. No MMA going on this weekend. Obviously, pretty quiet as we head into Christmas Day on Monday. Again, be safe. Hope you guys have a great holiday weekend. And next week, I don't know if we'll have the Q3 edition of this show or not. However, we will have a UFC 2 whatever it is preview, the year-end show, December 30th with Cyborg and Holly Holm, and a lot of other interesting storylines on that show. We will have a special guest next week and somebody that is pretty newsworthy because he is having his site launch on on Sunday. John Pollock. You guys remember John Pollock, obviously. He's been a guest on the show a couple times. He and I are going to talk about post-wrestling, what it is. I don't fully understand what it is, but I think I have a pretty good idea. So we're going to talk about that as well as do a preview for UFC at some point next week. So look for that. And then possibly Q3 next week, if not the week after for sure. And then we will go from there. So again, big thanks to Chad Dundas. Thanks to Sean Wheelock. And thanks to all you guys. You have a lot of choices in your podcasting day. I know I have dozens of podcasts in episodes, subscriptions, all this stuff in my iPhone right now. And it's tough. You know, you got to pick and choose and all that good stuff. And hopefully this is worth it. And if you guys have made it this far, it probably is. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for supporting us, the show, and all the great audio on our website as well. We definitely appreciate it. Can never say it enough. So thank you guys a lot. So with all that being said, we'll bid adieu to episode 85 of Josh Nason's Punch Out. And until next time, insert catchphrase here.